Hey guys. Okay, we're gonna start. What we're gonna talk about is actually something in, I guess it would be nuclear physics, but it's kind of broader than that. It has to do with the shape of space-time in general. And the thing that I want to briefly go over before handing it over to the rest of the crew, and we're going to go through different aspects of what was called the Moon Model. A man who worked on the Manhattan Project named Robert Moon, he came up with a model for the shape of the nucleus of the atom, which had never been done. It had been something that had been pondered about, but he was familiar with the movement. He was very much attracted to our movement, primarily because he viewed LaRouche as a moral person. But he hadn't really read much LaRouche, so one of the organizers actually went up to him and asked him, well, how much LaRouche have you read? And he said, well, you know, really not that much. He said, well, can I Xerox you some stuff and have you look at it? He said, all right. And what Moon did was he went to his house, and he read Kepler's Harmonia Mundi and a bunch of LaRouche, and about a week later came up with this model of the atomic nucleus, based upon a different epistemological outlook than what you'll find if you've been educated in science in the university system, this kind of thing. So the question that I want to kind of start off this panel is the question of, how do you know what you know? Right? What is the method by which you actually come to a hypothesis, a truthful hypothesis about the way the universe works? Now, something that goes back to the ideas of Plato and the Renaissance in general is the question of, well, what is the creator's intention? And how do you harmonize your own understanding of the universe with the shape of the universe in general? One of the things that Plato talked about was the idea that, it was kind of like recognizing a person from afar. You may or may not be correct, but you have some image or some idea about who that person is. And so from a distance, you can actually recognize that person. So he compared this to the idea of hypothesis, that maybe you are actually recognizing something that you've seen before. You're essentially recollecting knowledge. As applied to science, you have to ask yourself, well, how was Johannes Kepler essentially able to use this method of hypothesis to come up with a model of the planetary orbits that predicted the existence of a exploded or perhaps an unformed planet in the area outside of Mars, between Mars and Saturn? How was Gauss 200 years later able to predict the orbit of an asteroid called Ceres in this asteroid field that had never been before seen? Right? Sometimes, as far as hypotheses go, you know that you're onto the truth, that you're onto the trail of what is truthful long before your physical senses, even aided by instruments, are capable of observing this through sense perception. And in the same way, in about 1820, in 1825, a guy named Ampère was able to predict, or rather hypothesize about the existence of electromagnetic fields. 20 years after that, two men named Carl Friedrich Gauss and Wilhelm Weber were working together to basically confirm some of these ideas that Ampère had. Now, Ampère came by his hypotheses by attacking the epistemology. It's basically the ideology of Isaac Newton. Isaac Newton personally sought to destroy or rip off Kepler's ideas, tried to reduce them to basically a system of algebraic formalism. Now, Ampère, very polemically, I wish I had some of the paper to read to you. I'll read it later when I come back up here. But he very polemically goes after Newton. What he does in the beginning, he kind of says, well, Newton's this great guy. He has certain ideas about, you know, electromagnetism and these kinds of things, and that's really great, and you know, everybody loves Newton. And then through the course of the paper, he rips Newton. He disproves everything that Newton stands for. It's a very beautiful paper. So, Jason.
All right. So, we're going to start off looking at Kepler. But first, there's this, what Ed was talking about in terms of Newton. Who here has heard of Bertrand Russell before? Everybody. Almost, right? Anybody who's not heard of him before? Okay. People who aren't in the movement and have heard of him, what do you know about him? People who aren't members of the LaRouche campaign? Evil? No one in this crowd is going to say he was a great pacifist? No. Philanthropist? A humanitarian? Yeah. No, he was a filthy old racial racist. He was a total asshole. And he was a very evil guy in terms of the form of... He was very refined, though. As, you know, oligarchs can tend to be. You're very wealthy, you know, you got a lot of time to be refined. He had refined something that was going back all the way to, you know, in the time of Socrates and Plato, from the Sophists and the Eleatics, into Aristotle and then into Newton. But this idea that... And it's totally contrary to the way that you actually think. That the way you investigate something that's occurring is you look for all the things it's made out of, and you see how they operate with each other. Has anybody investigated the economy by taking money out of their wallet, looking at it, feeling their coins, playing heads and tails or something like that? Does anybody have money in their wallet anymore? Makes it harder. But you get this idea that with atomic theory, like if you're going to look at chemistry or you're going to look at life, you're looking at living organisms, you've got a living tree, you've got a cat that's walking around and purring and meowing, that the best way you understand how that purr occurs, or the best way you understand how that tree grows, is to take the tree, kill it, burn it, look at what it's made out of, take the cat, pull its vocal cords out, try to figure out how it purrs, and you have absolutely no idea how anything works, because we're going to get to this with the golden section, that when you've got something that's occurring as a process as a whole, which is shaping how all of the parts in it operate, you have to be a complete idiot to look at the parts and think that their reaction among themselves is going to explain the entire thing that's shaping them. So, that's called empiricism, that you know what you know through your senses, through trends in your senses, the things you think your senses might imply to you. But, have you ever sensed a cause? Did you ever see someone who was hungry? Did you ever see their hunger? All right. And certainly in terms of the atom, you obviously can't see anything. So there goes your theory of knowing things through your senses. Bill Clinton? Okay, Bill Clinton feels your pain. All right. No, but what Kepler's approach... This is referenced in the spherics panel last night. If you're looking at the approach to understanding how the heavens operate, we had gone how you can't see the stars moving. You can remember that they used to be in a different place. They've changed their location. Stars seem to move in a common way, except for some pesky stars that seem to change their place from week to week, the planets. And then in trying to understand them, as was said, you run into trouble if you're just trying to describe a sort of relationship between their movements. So just real quickly, these guys were all mentioned last night. Ptolemy, we said that the Earth, everything goes around the Earth. All the planets go around the Earth. Copernicus, we said that everything goes around the Sun. And then Tycho Brahe, who Kepler was working with, who said that the Moon and the Sun go around the Earth, and then everything else goes around the Sun. You know, the obvious trouble is that none of these people were considering why the planets were moving, or what kind of invisible hula hoops out in space the planets were moving on, or what was pushing them. There's kind of an unspoken idea that you can't really know the cause of anything. So Kepler had just the opposite approach. And his approach to, I guess you can't see any of these overheads, I'll just hold these up, but his approach to looking at the heavens was that he discovered or hypothesized a principle of gravitation. So you got to look at what's causing the planets to move. And what he had developed was this, it's really amazing to see, that there's a sort of a harmony that occurs between the orbits of the planets. That imagine you had a sphere, you had a little balloon, you're blowing it up inside this guy right here. So it's as big as it can get inside it. It'll touch each of the faces. The size of that sphere, that's how big the orbit of Mercury is. Venus is the size of the orbit that goes around this one. The sphere that goes around, yeah. The sphere that, if you condense the sphere down until it touched all the vertices, the size of that sphere is the orbit of Venus. And you can go on from there, and you can put you stick this around Venus, and you get the Earth on the outside of the icosahedron. You put the dodecahedron around the Earth, and you get Mars's orbit. Then between Mars and Jupiter, there's a big gap. You get the tetrahedron. Which, if you just look at this shape, you can tell that there's a pretty big difference between the sphere that goes around and the sphere that would be inside. It's pretty noticeable. There's a pretty big gap between Mars and Jupiter. And it has something else in it that Kepler had hypothesized, the asteroid belt. So you had this around Mars, and then finally... No, wait, where is this? Oh, yeah, yeah. So Jupiter's on the outside of this. And then, if Jupiter's inside the cube, Saturn is without it. So, is everybody... Who's not familiar with these odd shapes? Everybody's read the Timaeus dialogue completely? No? Oh, okay. All right. These are the... They're known as the Platonic solids. And what you get is that if you put a sphere around these, or inside, until it touched all the faces, it's going to evenly cut up the sphere. In other words, if you had put dots on the sphere in all the spots that this is on, that the cube is going to be touching it at, you know, you can just look at these and see that they're the same from every angle. And you only get five of them. These are the only five. We can talk later about, you know, why you can't make a sixth one. But you get this sort of a boundary condition to space on our scale. When you play around with space, it's not just, you can't just do whatever you want. It's not totally free and open. There's a principle that's guiding what you're able to do in it. And then Kepler found that on the macrocosm, on the size of the planets, you get these same five Platonic solids, governed by the golden section. Now, just I thought it would be fun to go through that. There's a paper that Kepler wrote about, well, he says it's about nothing. It's about snowflakes, which are almost nothing. I don't know if people are like really like Californians and they've never seen snow before, but who's seen snow before? Okay, most people. Is there anything you guys have noticed about snowflakes?
No two are ever the same.
No two are the same? Wait, you saw them all? All right, we have God in our midst. What else? What's that? Six sides, yeah. You've seen six. Has anyone seen five-sided snowflakes? Has anyone actually, you know, do they know that they've noticed one? Who's actually like looked at snowflakes instead of his?
Well, I've noticed that there's snowflakes in different kinds of roads. There's four. They might not have one in different colors.
Flat ones? You're saying flat snowflakes with?
They have kind of rings, and then the rings are connected.
By hexagons.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know. I've never seen a snowflake that wasn't a flat snowflake that wasn't a hexagon. Bring one in. Find one that you can keep in the freezer and we can take a look at it later. But with the way Kepler was approaching this question, think about if you went to like a physics professor today to tell him that you're dropping all your classes because you're joining LaRouche. If you went to that physics professor and you said, why does a snowflake have six sides? How do you think they'd begin investigating it? What do you think they'd start with? Put under a microscope? Okay, and what would they see if they put it under a microscope? Oh. Okay, so maybe they'll like spend lots of research money and move their lab to Antarctica or something. So they got their snowflakes, they're not melting. Or how would you approach it? Has anyone ever thought about why they come in these six sides? Just next time it's snowing, take a look at them. I mean, you get bigger ones land on like your gloves or something. You can really, you can see them pretty clear. Nobody has a hypothesis? All right, what's up?
Maybe it has something to do with the gravitational pull on other planets.
Of the other planets?
Or the effects of gravity and the tilt of the spin of the Earth. And I'm going to go with that one.
Okay. Well, Kepler was looking at that as one of his hypotheses, but he was saying he couldn't really understand why that would create six. you know, that you might get like a long snowflake because it's kind of being pulled. So like along the direction of gravity, you might get kind of like cylinder snowflakes. But yeah, he thought about that too. Huh. I'm going to pass this around real quick. Yeah, this is sticky. There's a really bad overhead, too. Maybe you can see it. Is that... That's not at all visible, huh?
I can't
even... You can see it. All right. Just kind of... Yeah. We do is Kepler decided that the best way to understand how snowflakes are formed would be to look at pomegranates and bees hives. That's what everybody was thinking, right? You're just too embarrassed to say it? You're just kind of shy? Yeah. Because what Kepler's approach, remember, this is the guy who discovered gravitation, not from looking at like balls pulling on each other, but from looking at the solar system as a whole. So in his approach to the snowflake, his stance is, okay, well, I'm going to figure this out by looking at what's the geometry or the shape of the domain in which these snowflakes are being created. The same way that these things tell you something about space, the limitedness of the five platonic solids, Kepler said, okay, well, let's look at the shape of space. I don't mean like which size shoebox is space. But I mean, we'll get at this more at the moon model. It'll make some more sense. What he was looking at is, okay, so you've got that, the honey is kind of getting passed around kind of slowly and being licked.
Honey, we're getting it on our hands.
You can eat it. What he got is, so if you can see that, raise your hand. Great. Okay. So you got like a hexagon with like one of those Chevron logos in the middle? Or Citgo, I mean, right? Yeah, Citgo. The Mercedes. You got this. What you do is, if you look at the beehives, Kepler's saying, okay, well, what would be the best way that a bee could shape its hive? He says, you know, obviously you're not going to look at the bee for this. Bees don't exactly think about how to best make a beehive. They're bees, right? They're probably not finding a bunch of hexagonal-shaped leaves off of trees and like taking them back to their nest and putting them in their beehive and building it around that. So the way you're going to have to approach it is, you got to say, okay, well. Actually, I'll read you this quote. Funny, you can get a sense of his sense of playfulness. He said, "These then are the reasons which concern necessity in the material. They are, in my opinion, sufficient to excuse me from arguing at this point about the perfection, beauty, or dignity of the rhomboid, or from bestirring myself to conjure up, from a meditation on the shape that the bee builds, the inner nature of its diminutive soul. We would have had to embark on something of the kind if no utility in the shape had come to light." Because what he's looking at is, if you look at, well, I don't know if people can see those. If you take does anyone have a big, fat pocket full of change? Yeah, I've got some pennies, that'd be great. Okay, great. All right. Oh, this is great. Okay.
Okay, that's more.
All right. So if you're looking at arranging these, arranging in a flat plane, if you're looking at how to arrange these in a plane, all these pieces that you've got, it has nothing to do with the shape of the circular coins that you've got here. If you squish them around, you get a couple of... Well, here, it just naturally goes like this. Oh. Okay. What kind of shape do you see there?
Triangle.
Okay, triangle. Anything else?
Diamonds are like this concave one?
Hexagon.
Huh.
Yeah,
hexagon, right? Triangles make hexagons. The other way you can do it is stable. What do you get there?
Square.
Hmm? And the only shapes that you can actually use that are going to sit together flatly? And flat things are triangles, squares, and hexagons. But then he was also approaching this from the standpoint of, okay, how about in terms of filling up volume instead of just being flat? Like here, I got a bunch of these things. They're all, got a few layers of the square. One way you can set them together, can you guys, I don't know if that's really seeable. Here we go. You can put them together like this in a cube. Indeed, if you imagine that you were the guy inside the middle, how many other spheres is that sphere in the middle of this cube touching?
Six.
Six, right? This is actually one of Kepler's first hypotheses in the paper, is that the snowflakes aren't actually completely flat, but they're three lines coming together like an octahedron. If you connect opposite vertices on this octahedron, you get three lines, like that, which also connects the faces of a cube. Another thing you get, if you wanted these to take up less space, you set them off kilter a little bit, like that. You guys see anything? The hexagon came back. Here's the center of the hexagon flower. Right. Also, if you started with the other way of stacking things, in terms of the triangle or hexagon way of doing it, okay, you can start with a layer of this. And you can take each layer above. You could put them right on top. Right like that. Do you know what shape these would become if you squished them? Or how many is each one? Can you get a sense of how many each sphere here is touching? How many other spheres?
Five.
Well, take a look here. How many is it touching on its own plane level?
Six.
Okay. One above and one below? Does that make okay sense? Okay. In which case, these things, if you squeeze them, we've got some Play-Doh, we're going to try squeezing it to see what kind of shapes we get, is you get honeycomb-shaped things. Oh, that's gone now.
Say that again. Could you explain what you mean by touching? Because, like, you say touching, like, we're all touching each other.
Well, this one's not touching this one.
But you mean all of them touching whatever that is?
For any particular one, like, take this middle guy right here, it's being touched by, there are six spheres that are actually touching it. You know, these ones aren't actually touching it. And then when you're making layers out of it, one way is you could sit them directly above and below each other, so it would have six on its plane, one on this side and one on the other. Or, look if you do it this way. If you set them kind of nestled inside each other again, this way it seems to make a pyramid. What do you see? This is kind of hard to see. Yeah, you see hexagons for sure. It was built out of hexagons, right? We started with triangles. What do you see happening right here? Anybody see that? Here. You see the part of the plane? Like, if you continue these over to your right, you get six balls that are part of the pyramid that are arranged in the square fashion.
Mm-hmm.
You guys see that?
Yep.
Okay. It's a pretty interesting way to figure out what a snowflake is made out of. What he's going through and looking at the nature of packings in space, and that actually if you take this form here, how far is that honeycomb made it around, by the way? Where is it right now? It's like only this half has seen it so far? Okay, pass it quicker. As you get with honeycomb, is you get two different layers. You look at it from the top, you see hexagonal shapes. You look at it from the other side, you see hexagonal shapes. And they come together not head on, but kind of in the spaces between themselves. That's why you get this shape. So now if you look through the honeycomb, can you guys see this? There's a hexagon here with this. Yeah, when you get the honeycomb, you'll be able to see it. So let's try it. What we got right here is a pyramid of a silly putty here. And the idea is, you kind of squish it. We'll find out what it looks like inside. Well, we can pass some of these around. You can compare them to the honeycomb. Yeah, here's a good one. Okay.
I'm going to pass a couple of these around.
What's that? No, that's not really going to work. Yeah. So you get this also with the pomegranates, the shape of pomegranate seeds. If you've eaten pomegranate seeds, they look kind of like jewels. They're not round. They've got kind of like, they look like little crystals. You know, they come together at the end as though like there's like a polished diamond. You get, that's the same sort of thing. It's the same sort of packing of space. So Kepler's approach was, don't look at ice. Don't look at crystals. You know, you didn't exactly have, like, super scanning electron microscopes at the time or anything. And that wouldn't help you. So, no, you got, what's the nature of the space? What's the nature of the shape of the domain that these things are acting in? And you take that overall approach to things. Like, here, let's just, who's heard of the golden ratio? Who really knows, who's, like, totally, you know, they got what that means, why it's important? People have heard that like you get like these ratios, like from one knuckle to another is the golden ratio, or like from your top of your head to your belly button to the bottom, or like the size of your like nostrils, or I don't know, you get it all sorts of different places, I suppose. You get plants growing in a certain way. But why, that's what you see, just like you see the snowflake. But what is it about life that gives the operation of life a shape such that the golden ratio appears in living things? Right. It's the same kind of question that Kepler is asking about the snow. What's the shape of the domain the snow is forming in?
The molecular structure of the snowflake, the components of the molecular structure of the snowflake, I don't know if Kepler really touched on that, but could it be that?
Okay, but why would they? You might look at molecules and see they're arranged that way, but still the question would be why. Right, it would be like, you could get a super microscope and look at all sorts of like parts of cells and find the golden ratio here and there and, you know, figure something out about it. It still doesn't tell you what is it about life that this ratio would come up. But in terms of what it is, let's say you have any sort of line, you got some sort of length. Can everybody see that? Is it okay if it's this low, or do I need to raise it up? Oh. Okay.
Can we hold this?
Yeah. Okay. If anyone has better whiteboard markers, please come up. Okay. So you got some sort of length. Now, if you wanted to create proportion, if you cut this length anywhere, if you divide it, you create a proportion, right? If you cut it right in half, you got a piece that's one compared to the whole, which is two, and another piece that's one. Oh. All right. Or you could have cut it right here. If you snipped it right there, you'd get, you know, say three over here, you get one over here, the whole thing is made out of four. So you get a ratio of three compared to four, one compared to four, 3 compared to 1. There's a number of ratios there. What do you guys think ratio has to do with living things? They're growing? Okay. But crystals grow too. What is it about? What is it about the growth of a living organism that makes it different from the growth of a salt crystal, a rock candy? Have you ever grown rock candy and it's forming in the jar and it starts forming like little arms and legs and eyes?
No.
Rock candy hair. It just looks this, it's the same everywhere, right?
Yeah.
You're growing a salt crystal. What's up?
Maybe because everything grows, like the salt crystal
is. So think about this thing from the beginning about reductionism and Bertrand Russell. Don't crystals grow based only on what is the outside layer of that crystal? It really is like you're adding to things piece by piece. In a human being, like the growth of your nose, it's not like your ear is like creating a nose over here, right? Or you got some sort of like one eye is like magnetic north and the other is magnetic south. So you have to have two eyeballs or something like that. Or you're, I don't know, you'll like fly towards the North Pole. Right? There's something else there in living organisms. There's something that's not in any of the pieces. It's like, you know, if you cut something up into a lot of pieces, it's not alive anymore. And Kuza goes through this in On Conjectures. He's looking at, okay, if you've got a rock, you can break a rock in half and you still get, like, rocks. You take a plant, there are parts of a plant you can pull off and you can still plant in the ground and it'll grow. Now, some plants better than others. But there's more of a unity to them. There's a sort of a oneness that isn't breakable into parts. And by the time you get to an animal, if you cut a piece of an animal off, you don't get another animal. Right? Like you pull a lizard's tail off, the lizard grows another tail, but that tail, like you can't put it in warm water and the lizard grows out of the tail or anything. Right? you can't cut off like a dog's... Yeah, fine, you cut off the arm of a sea star, it could grow another arm, but the arm does not become another sea star. What is it? How does it eat? It doesn't even have a mouth. How's it going to grow another sea star? No, it's in the middle. It's in the middle of a starfish.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Or like a dog, right? If you take a dog's leg off, you can't make a dog out of it. That leg is not a dog. Right. So you've got this thing with human beings, or with living organisms. There's a certain oneness to them that isn't in the parts, that the way they're developed isn't proximally. It's not based on proximal relations of things next to each other. So think about, in terms of ratio, living things embody a sense of ratio. And there's a relationship between each part and the whole. Each part plays a certain role that's guided by the entire development of the organism. So then when you come to the question of ratio, you can ask yourself, okay, which ratio is just pure ratio? This is why it's called the divine proportion. In the same way that God doesn't require anything outside of himself, Pacioli wrote that the divine proportion is divine and that it requires nothing outside of it. Like 2 to 1, 2 came from outside. However, if you thought about a ratio, such that the relationship between one part to the other is the same as a part to the entire thing, there's nothing in that ratio outside of just the idea of ratio itself. There's no number in this ratio. So this is the divine proportion. This is the golden mean, another name that it's called. That this portion is in regards to this, the larger one, as the larger is in regards to the whole. And the reason that you see living things organized, the domain of the operation of living organisms arranged in this sense, is that living organisms embody ratio, or a oneness to them. That's why you got pentagons, you got five fingers, you got five toes, you got five big limbs. Look at other animals, count up their toes. You don't find like seven-toed elephants or anything like that. So I think that should get a sense of Kepler's approach.
So the Egyptians had a principle of eternal scales of proportionality that many of you might be familiar with. It was called the principle of Ma'at. And the essence of it is that after you die, Ma'at weighs your heart against what was called the divine feather of justice, which was the lightest thing they could find. And if your heart, if through the course of your life you had found a way to get rid of, to discard all of your anger and hatred and these sorts of negative vices, then after death your heart would even out with the, you know, that it would, if it would be lighter than the divine feather of justice, then your heart would rise to the heavens as opposed to the alternate. So the chemistry, in talking about chemistry, it's a really young science that goes, it's less than 300 years old, essentially, in terms of really breakthroughs in chemistry. And yet we have this, we've been bequeathed a huge field of knowledge with chemistry. So so maybe some of you, or maybe were there an invisible professor sitting in the front row, you know, who snuck in from UCLA or some other fine institution, you know, maybe he might object and say, well, you know, I'm not surprised that he's about to start talking about CUSA, because, you know, he's supposed to be talking about Lavoisier and the roots of chemistry, but you know, these people, they're poor, and they spend all their money on esoteric pamphlets, so they can put cardboard you know, shapes together. But when it comes to real science, like we do at Caltech and UCLA in our nice laboratories, you know, they can't really deal with that. So even though we can't deal with the principles, you know, they found a couple paradoxes in the history of science. Nobody else cares about Kepler. But so, no, none of my students can answer questions about that. You know, maybe I can't either, but, you know, but they can't do real science anyway. So what does it matter? And so anyway, I guess we're out to dispel that myth. At the same time, though, I don't want to make it look like it's too easy. I, on the one hand, I want to get across that the epistemological basis that maybe a lot of the people have that are here is probably enough that we could see in the next years out of this gathering of people actual discoveries, breakthroughs in fields of science. That it would not be out of the question. And I think that's part of why LaRouche has identified this moon model as one of the frontiers of science and of expanding the whole noosphere. But before we get to that, the CUSA has a dialogue, which I was going to talk more of Lavoisier, but I think it wouldn't do him justice exactly. Because we have so many preconceived notions. Lavoisier discovered the so-called, what we now call elements, and so it's a tremendous task to try to think about it, which just takes time in and of itself to even try to think about air as if you didn't know that you were breathing air. You know, it sort of seems like, oh, sure, you know, everybody always knew it's air, that's what we breathe. Some guy came up, gave it a name, you know, he called it oxygen, so what? You know, but really, in order to really identify, to isolate certain paradoxes about these things is a clever, more than clever. It takes genius, but at the same time, it takes the same epistemology that many of you use every day, and many scientists at some of the most expensive laboratories have never used. So, this is a piece of CUSA. Called, and I say CUSA, then, you know, maybe there's other people, not the invisible professor anymore, but maybe organizers that are now saying, okay, you know, now some CUSA, you know, as if, you know, you can't, because how could you go wrong with CUSA, you know? It's going to be epistemologically sound. It's going to be so broad it would apply to anything. I could basically read some CUSA, and then, you know, you could say, okay, yeah, that applies to everything, as though, you know, it's somehow a magician's trick that we go from, the panel's intent is to go from, you know, this kind of thing that has all this stuff that modern science doesn't have, And then somehow we're going to get at the end, we're going to try to get back to that in modern science somehow, that somehow that has some connection. And then so I'm just here as sort of the magician to try to put you to sleep so that then when you wake up and me comes out, you know, all of a sudden we're back to these shapes again and it's modern science. And you say, damn, I fell asleep. Otherwise I would have figured out, you know, how did we get there? You know, but really, this is not even your average CUSA. This is practical stuff. It's called the Idiota de Staticis, and it's a dialogue on the with the popular the layman who was a very CUSA like character, but he's just the idiot, you know, the layman. And he's talking about experiments done with weight scales. And so the dialogue starts out, and I don't really know it that well, because I wasn't joking. I really was going to talk a lot more about Lavoisier, but I changed my mind last minute. So it starts out with this orator that he often speaks with, this Roman orator. And he's praising scales as though these are scales of justice. The state needs them. They're necessary instruments of the state and so forth, you know, but not really anything too specific. And so, the layman says, yeah, this, you know, nothing's exactly precise. It's really hard to get precision, but with scales, you do get a certain kind of precision that is hard to find anywhere else. So he says it would be, you know, an amazing thing if anyone had ever written the different weights of different objects. Because even if the objects seem to be the same, if they came from different origins, they couldn't possibly have the same weight. And so the orator says that he's never heard of anything like that. And the layman says that this would be of some, you know, some great importance if it were done. So the orator says, well, perhaps, you know, you could do that. You know, is that possible? And the layman says, well, you know, I think that anybody could actually do it if they knew how to do it. It's not that difficult, but I just don't have the time. But I could tell you, you know, the usefulness of it, and then maybe you could do it. Or, you know, and the orator says, sure, you know, I'll do it, or I'll find somebody that could do it if you can tell us why it would be useful to do this. So he says that he starts out by saying there might be hidden aspects of these things that we could get at, that we could unseen things that could be brought out through a manner of finding out these kinds of weights. So he says, let's say that you have water coming from some source. What the layman says in Kuz's dialogue is that if it came from another source, we could show that the weight was different. That we could get enough water that we could put it on these scales and show that this water came from this source, this water came from that source. They actually have different weights. And so he also says, and also because of that, we might even see that even water within, you know, say further from the source of the same river might actually have a slightly different weight. But even if we found two that seemingly had the same weight, we'd know they didn't have the same weight. Epistemologically, we just know that they're different because they come from a different origin and they can't be exactly the same. But sometimes things may seem to be, within our level of precision, they may seem to be the same. So we might find some water at the beginning closer to the source, water later in the source of the same river, and it may seem to be close enough to the same. Or we might find two rivers nearly alike. But we might learn a lot if we actually got different weights of different rivers and actually weighed them out. So then the orator says, well, you know, gee, do you think that every situation is going to be the same as with water? You know, is it really a principle that everything that comes from a different origin is going to have that's going to have an actual different weight just because it's of a different origin? And so he says, yeah, sure, identical sizes, whatever you want to bring, it's going to be that there's going to be a different weight. So how helpful would it be to a physician then, he goes through, if you could actually go through the weight of, say, blood of an individual, then go through the, you know, you take the urine of the individual and so forth, and then we could start to take an individual when they're sick, an individual when they're healthy, measure the weight of the urine, you know, of people from such a region in Germany when they're healthy, and so on and so forth. And And so, you know, by recording all these weights, you could, you know, the physician might be able to get at something that something sort of unseen that no one else could really get at. And so he says, well, you know, because normally, I mean, and it was a practice to, you know, that normally things that they can try to get at by the color of urine or by the taste of it or the smell of it, things that, well, you know, if they didn't have that, they didn't have, you know, advanced computers to do their HMO gathering of, you know, so they had to do other things. So, but he said by doing these things with weights, we might be able to get a whole nother aspect where we could get, where we could start to see something else going on in this urine. And then he says, and furthermore, you know, we could go on and we could actually, we'll use these weights in another way. We'll start to do things. Do you guys know what like water clocks are? It's I think the Greeks probably called them kloops hydras. It's just a clock and water put together. But basically it's, I think the Egyptians actually discovered it. If you take like a 70 degree angle, I think, then there normally if we took I just almost reached right in there. I don't know if that's on or not, but I was gonna reach one of those glasses in there.
Don't take them out.
So if we had a hole in the bottom here, say, water would be dripping out, but as it got lower, say it went drip, drip, drip. Yeah, exactly. As it got lower, we didn't have as much weight on the top, so it would start to get slower. With that 70-degree incline, no matter what, it's always going to be the same. If it's a stream, it's going to be a stream. If it's going to be a drip, it's going to be a drip. So you can measure out the same amount of time, you know, without a computer. And so what he said was, let's take the breath of an individual. Let's see how many respirations it takes to get to 100 or so. And then let's see how much weight of water we got, and let's weigh that against someone else. So then we'll take sick people, how many respirations they take in 100 respirations. Let's weigh that. Let's weigh that to against the he also goes through things like the heartbeat, the pulses. We'll take 100 pulses and things. So you can get respirations, pulses, weights of healthy, weights of unhealthy, weights of old, weights of young. And if you do this, then you can start to get at certain unseen problems that you could have an amazing physician, he says, that would be able to tell things that no other physician would be able to tell. You know, which, I mean, people do, if you've ever gone to the doctor, or a decent doctor, maybe they don't even do it anymore, but, they do this stuff. They don't weigh it out with a water clock, but they measure your blood pressure. You know, that's so they can get a sense of, you might have problems with your heart or something that they can't see, except for that they find, oh wow, you know, this person is not matching up with what, you know, with other things. So then they can do more tests and so forth. So the order is kind of impressed. Okay, fine. You know, that's some cool stuff for a physician, but if he's right, then what else can we really do with it? And so the layman says, well, let me show you. You know, this is what we could do is we could actually start to try to get at weights of different things and get at the true weights, because certainly if we weighed something and it was weighed in the north, or if we weighted in the south, things are going to be slightly of a different weight. So what he would say is we need to try to start to find these means of weights, and the way we find a mean of weight is by either we'd have to go to all these different areas and weigh them in all these different areas, or we can do start to do what he calls a method of adjusting. And so the orator says, well, I don't really know what you mean by this adjusting. So he says, well, I'll show you. So He takes a piece of wood, and he breaks it up into a proportion. Say it's a 3-pound piece of wood, and he takes 2 pounds of it and 1 pound of it. So you have a double proportion. And he puts it into the water, and shows how with the same kind of proportion, you all of a sudden get a difference in motion. That as he removes the sticks, the 2-pound piece of wood comes up to the top 5 times faster than the other one. So the orator says, well, gee, what just went on there? And he says, well, these are the kinds of adjustments we're going to have to make, because just as the one partook of more heaviness, then if we find that the lightness of this wood is actually going to, the more we have of it, the more it partakes of this lightness. And we start to get different motions. And so he talks about how we could take all of these different kinds of things and start to measure these equal volumes, round volumes of them and so forth. Because we wouldn't want to displace too much water like a ship and mess up our weights. But so he goes through, I'll go through just a little bit more, and then but what you'll see is that all the foundations of chemistry are based on simple things all the instrumentation that's even in the expensive laboratories and so forth, where if you take away the digital, if you actually go to what the original thing is, all the beakers, flasks, anything like that, these things were all basically developed by Lavoisier in order to try to start to isolate some unseen principles in things like air. How are we going to figure out how to weigh this? How are we going to figure out? Because it's not the, I think that the easiest thing to get into with some of the more modern science, especially things like chemistry, is that, well, you know, it's so far along now. You know, there's really no way. The lay person couldn't really participate actively in frontiers of chemistry. It's sort of beyond, you know, now we're into nuclear physics and everything else. This is not something you can do at home. But it is. I mean, everything that Lavoisier and Mendeleev did is already in this De Staticis Experimentis. It was genius of them what they did, but at the same time, it's also that they knew whose shoulders to stand on, or somehow they figured out, if they didn't know Kuza explicitly, they figured out, you know, without seeing him, where to stand on whose shoulders. But it's the way that if, well, forget it. I don't. But anyway. So back to the dialogue. I had a point, at the end of it, he actually starts to get into some of the very things. Some of the things that LaRouche talked about this morning. I mean, the Archimedes, the principle of Archimedes. He lays it out here and actually goes more into what other kinds of things you could do with simple weights, getting at powers of stones and things like this. If you took magnets, how much weight would you have to put on the other? You know, if you had a magnet and an equal amount of weight, then once the magnet was suspended, how much weight would have to be removed for it to come back into equilibrium? That would be a way of measuring the power of different kinds of magnets. You could apply the same thing to different kinds of how much water might be in seeds. Or he even talks about how you might take a field that was, say, on a hill and try to start to measure what the difference in the power of the sun is from it, by, say, taking the grains of wheat, that if you keep all things equal, then the only difference between the one side of the hill and the other, if the soil is of the same fertility and so forth, is that if you took, say, 1,000 grains of wheat from one side of the hill and 1,000 grains of the other, we might be able to start to see a certain kind of different power of the sun acting on one side or the other, and we could take note of that. They start to apply it to everything. Even, you know, the orator says, well, could we apply it to could we apply it to things like figuring out proportionalities of how deep water is and things like this through all these weights? He says, well, what if, yeah, sure, what if we had what if we took a sort of a moon shaped anchor, and we put an apple on one side and we put a weight on the other, so that when it got to the bottom, it would tilt over to this side. Then when it gets to the bottom, it tilts over to this side, the apple is released, and the whole while we've got a water clock going. So then when we see the apple come back to the top, then we take the amount of weight of that water, and we start to get certain correlations between different weights of water when you see the apple coming back, different weights when it's deeper and so forth, and you can start to get proportionalities of of deepness in the water, or he applies it to velocity and the speed that ships are moving, and how you could use a crossbow and do a similar thing, and then they get into astronomy and they start to apply it to basically, I mean, he lays down the basis of how you would even start to measure discrepancies in retrogradations and things like this, of by using sort of the weight from a water clock, following different speeds of how long it took for risings and settings of stars and the sun and other things at various times of the year and so forth, and gets at what it would take to actually get these kinds of retrogradations. So he ends it then with a discussion where he's starting to be asked about music. And this kind of gets into the harmonies, where if we later had more time, maybe if we had hours to really try to think through some of Lavoisier's experiments, then we could get at some of the harmonics that he speaks of. But he says that I'll just actually read it, because this applies actually to very much to what LaRouche said. Regarding there not being this morning, regarding there not being geometry as such, but physical geometry, where he was talking about when he was about 12 or so and didn't like the idea of this geometry in the classroom. How could they talk about a beam without talking about how strong the beam was and so forth, you know, or that more steel might make the thing, you know, more weak and so forth. So he says, and this part, I guess I'll just read. So if you can bear with it for 2 minutes, then I'll be done. And you know, no sleight of hand. We'll be getting right into the next thing. But the orator says, okay, now that enough has been said on that, it seems. What about? Is there anything that this has to do with musical sounds? And the layman says, well, experiments done with weight scales are very useful with regard to music. For example, from the difference of the weight of two bells of constant tone, it is known of which harmonic proportion the tone consists. Those in our Mons Brigade know that we don't have time to go into the harmonic proportion at this juncture. But we almost got into fisticuffs the last time that was brought up. But likewise, the weight of music pipes and the water filling the pipes. There is known the proportion of the octave, of the fifth, and of the fourth, and all the harmonies, howsoever formable. Similarly, the harmonic proportion from the weight of mallets, from whose striking on an anvil there arises a certain harmony, and from the weight of drops dripping from a rock into a pond and making various musical notes, and from the weight of flutes and of all musical instruments, we could arrive more precisely at by the means of the weight scale. So the orator says, oh, so even as regards harmonic proportion of voices and songs, we could use weight. Yeah, all concordant harmonies are, in general, very accurately investigated by means of weights. Indeed, the weight of a thing is, properly speaking, a harmonic proportion that has arisen from various combinations of different things. Even the friendships and the animosities of animals and of men of the same respective species, as well as their customs and whatever other such thing, are weighed from harmonic concordances and from opposing dissonances. Likewise, too, both a man's health and his lack of health are weighed in terms of harmony. And so, too, are his flightiness and seriousness, his prudence and naivete, and many other such things, if you pay careful attention. So he says, to end it, what do you think about geometry? He says, well, I think that the close proportions between a circle and a square, and all other things that pertain to figures' different capacities, can be experienced more suitably by means of weights than by any other means. For example, if you make a cylindrical vessel of a known diameter and height, and make a second cubical vessel of the same diameter and height, and fill them both with water and weigh them, then you will know from the difference of weights the proportion of an inscribed square to the circle within which it is inscribed. And thereby it will be known to you, in terms of close surmise, the squaring of the circle. And whatever else in this regard you desire to know. Likewise, if you take two sheets of completely equal metal, and bend one of them into a circle by making a cylindrical vessel, and if you form the other one into a square by fashioning a cubical vessel, and if you fill the vessels with water, Then you will know from the difference of their weights the difference in area between a circle and a square of equal perimeter. Likewise, if you have more than one such sheet of metal, you will be able to investigate the different capacities in the case of a triangle, a pentagon, a hexagon, and so on. Similarly, by means of considering weight, you will be able to attain unto the art of the capacities of any shape of vessel whatsoever, and unto an understanding of the instruments of measuring and weighing. Attain unto how weight scales are made, and how 1 pound elevates 1,000 pounds in proportion to its distance from the center, and in proportion to its various straighter or more curved arc of descent, and how all the subtle devices of ships and machines are to be made. Hence I think that experimentation done with weight scales is very useful for all things pertaining to geometry. And then they sort of wrap it up. But the point of it all, I guess, is just that the roots of chemistry, if we can explore it, you know, with more hours of actual experimentation and so forth, they're there in an epistemology which you're very familiar with. And there's stuff in this that has never even been done, as far as I can tell, or things that have just been sort of had the surface touched, that maybe people here could end up exploring. And so that goes into some of our fellow organizers that have done some experimentation, and they'll explain. I mean, some of these things aren't necessarily original experiments, but they're getting at the point where we can start to look into some things that haven't been done before.
We're just going to look at one in terms of the chemistry pretty quick. You guys probably notice there's a tank here. There's a couple of glasses in it. In terms of looking at what water is made out of, what we were trying to do it here. Let me plug this. Well, let's put this in first. Wait, not yet.
Okay. All right, go ahead. Oh, okay.
Because what we're going to try and do is look at the relationships of the combinations of gases. You doing anything? Is it plugged in? Oh.
Shit, what?
No, it's might have broken in the last 5 minutes.
Right, try plugging it in this other plug. Oh, just don't let Marty know. I guess he heard that.
We can unplug this orange one here.
Well, no, because this orange one, it actually does work, right?
Oh, does it work with your power supply?
See, the light turns on.
Here, what's the TV plug?
Okay. Oh, no.
You're not doing anything.
Oh, there it goes.
You doing something?
We've got some spare parts. We can make another one of these things.
What is the AC/DC thing over there?
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah. Oh, we got another one.
Oh, we got a spare.
Always be prepared with a backup battery.
I don't know if you're plugging the thing. Screw these things there.
Oh, is it doing something now finally? Yeah. Well, it went about 10 times faster when it was when we got plugged in properly.
You can see it bubbling.
Yeah, you can see it bubbling. Now, what we were trying to do is a simple experiment of taking. People have probably seen, if they've heard water called H2O before. Like, okay, whatever that means. The idea is that, is it still doing something?
Stop.
Oh, this is just blue.
Marty's out too, I think.
Uh-oh.
What do you mean?
No, this is...
What do you mean he's out? You mean like he's not
the
here?
The circuit breaker.
No, he's blanked out too.
I guess he's...
Oh, like all the power is out.
Circuit breakers here.
Oh. There's like probably too much plugged in one.
What's the way? Hey, grab this orange thing. What's it plugged into?
I think there's two. Let him unplug some stuff.
No, the black thing is that what we're using. Oh, no, it isn't. Yeah. Hey, Ed, grab the orange thing and plug in the other one. Hopefully we can get this going again.
Yeah, let's try another outlet.
Wait a minute, if you try this in plain water, if you try taking the water apart with this plain water with nothing in it, it goes like so incredibly slow, it makes like a bubble every minute, like a tiny little bubble. But this is, if you just take these, I'll do it if this works again. If you could just toss, well, why don't we put it in there? There's no other outlets then. You can find the circuit breakers. If you put these electrodes in, we can do some more of this tonight. If you put them in plain water, it goes incredibly slow. I had a little bubble. It's like very slow. This is actually, this has got a huge amount of Epsom salt in it. And when you dissolve things in the water, it goes a whole lot quicker. So one thing we had tried before, this thing's got plain old regular like table salt in it, and we'll try that tonight. The cool thing is it makes green chlorine gas. And then if you add vinegar to it, the green chlorine gas like turns into hydrochloric acid or something and eats away the electrodes. And it leaves behind something, and if you burn it, it has green flames. So we can do that tonight once it gets dark.
Okay.
And but we'll have to come back tonight because this thing isn't working right now. So.
But we'll just still explain that. That's the principle.
Huh? Oh, yeah. Oh, this fuse might even go. Okay. Well, the principle behind this is that you get this interesting thing that's like... Various substances weigh different amounts. Like, if you look at, like, the weight of some chemical that combines with the weight of another chemical, you don't find, like, cool ratios in them. There's nothing very interesting about it. But when you have gases combining, you get simple proportions between the volumes of gas. Like, one thing you can do, once you take the water apart into the two different gases, you can take the two gases, mix them together, put a spark to it, and it turns back into water. And it uses up all of the gas in a 2-to-1 ratio. So the hypothesis, it's called the law of simple proportions, and this is worked on by a guy named Gay-Lussac. This is before Lavoisier even. What they're hypothesizing is, okay, you've got gases being used in simple proportions between each other, like same amount of this gas and the other gas combining, or 3 times this to 2 of this, which led them to think that on the small, that the substance of this matter, what the stuff's actually made out of, is a simple combination of the different kinds of gases. You get the idea of the hypothesis of an individual molecule existing, of an individual substance that's combined and making up your matter from looking at gas volumes.
Did you say that again?
Yeah.
Maybe you should say it in the microphone.
Oh. Yeah, what you get is, although it's not true for solids, like if you've got like, if you take baking powder and salt and put in some boiling water, it'll fizzle up. But the ratio of the weights of baking powder and salt that get used up when you have that reaction occur is not like a simple. It's not like twice as much baking soda as salt, or like 4 to 3. There's not a simple ratio between them. When you look at gases, though, you measure gases by volume usually instead of their weight because they're very hard to weigh, and it's pretty easy to measure like the volume of a gas. If you have like some, let's say a 2-liter bottle of hydrogen and a 2-liter bottle of oxygen, and you kind of mix them together and you get a spark going on, and so it's turning itself into water. And we should be able to do this tonight, hopefully. You get itself turning back into water, you'll have 1 liter of oxygen left. In other words, you'll have seen that 2 liters of hydrogen combined with 1 liter of the oxygen to make water. And you know that because you've got 1 liter of oxygen left, which makes the hypothesis that the substance of the water itself is 2 parts hydrogen to 1 part oxygen, which leads you to the hypothesis that on the small, water is made out of these little things. They're 2 hydrogen to 1 oxygen. It leads to the hypothesis of the molecule but you're not looking at the small. Just like Kepler didn't look at the snowflake, these guys, when they're looking at the nature of matter, they weren't looking, you know, with microscopes, looking at like water droplets, because you're never going to see anything. They looked at the volume of gases in like large amounts and their combination. So you see the unseen, you know, through the effects that you are able to observe to make a hypothesis. And we're going to be getting at that with the electronics now, because this isn't working.
Which is also what Danny took up with the whole thing with the water weight and so forth.
Yeah. The measurement. You notice this one's a little bit blue, too. That's another trouble, is when you put the Epsom salt in to make it go faster, things get screwed up. Like, eventually, this red one is going to, like, completely rust away and fall off, and it'll stop working. And it also makes this weird blue crud, and this one makes some white film. So you don't, it kind of, and you do it with regular table salt. Yeah, this is Epsom salt.
Is that the salt that makes it white?
It's magnesium sulfate. I guess magnesium is what you're seeing there. This is regular table salt. What this does is it makes this green stuff, and that eats the electrode away real quick, and then the whole thing stops working, because it just eats away the wire. So it doesn't really make any oxygen. All the energy that could have made little bubbles just go into destroying your wire. Which we'll try tonight. The salt one's pretty cool.
One of the issues with some of these experiments is that you need a certain amount of voltage and current to do some of these things. This down here only works if you have a certain amount of current, but the idea here...
Oh, I've got this, if that broke. This is 2 amps.
2 amps?
Yeah.
2 amps. Yeah. Actually, the battery is... It's okay, I don't have time to set this up. The idea here is that you have two circuits. The current can either go down this way or it can go down this way. And some of the experiments that, what's his name? Is it Louis? Louis Ampere?
Huh?
What's Ampere's first name?
Marie?
It's
like Marie something, right?
Something Marie, isn't it? I can't remember. So anyways, Mr. Ampere did some experiments where he was studying what happens when you take two circuits where the current is going the same way and what's the difference when you flip the direction of one of the circuits. And what he found is that when the electricity is going in the same direction down both wires, they actually attract each other. There's actually a physical attraction, and when you flip the current, then there's a repulsion. He did various experiments like these and actually came up with an idea that there must be some kind of magnetic fluid inside these small invisible particles or some kind of fluid that we would not be able to detect. But he certainly knew their behaviors, and he theorized that you would have some type of magnetic particle producing this effect, that it had to be some physical property of the various things he was studying. So, and it was this type of thinking that was very much reflective of this Platonic quality of hypothesis versus Newton's, you know, I don't make hypotheses, you know, type of nonsense. So what I've done here is I've actually suspended a wire using very thin wire, because one of the problems is that the weight of the wire actually prevents it from moving a little bit, so you have to set it up so that it's free hanging. And these things are actually very sensitive. If you look at Ampere's experiments, we have some pictures in the 21st century. I mean, these things were beautifully done. I mean, the craftsmanship of these things were very impressive. You know, what I've done doesn't compare at all. But another thing that Ampere actually studied was what happens when you take a wire and you wrap it around some kind of cylinder. It doesn't necessarily have to be a metal. I think Jason actually took somewhere, he made a cylinder out of plastic and wrapped the wire around the cylinder. What Ampere found is that when you do this, one end of the cylinder actually acts like the north pole of a bar magnet and the other end acts as the south pole. So what happens is that if you actually connect this to a battery, like this. Here's my other alligator clip. Okay. Like this. Alright. Oops. Alright. And whoever, I think it was Amir Sky, they got very fancy and put a switch on this thing, so. So, the current is broken right now, and there's nothing going on. Now I depress the switch. And I release the switch. Alright. Let's see. I have another one, which is no metal inside, it's just plastic, but the important similarity between this and the other one is that the wire is tracing out a circle, or rather there's a circular rotation to this. That's not going to be proper.
Real weak.
Real weak.
Well, you can see it there, you can see it spinning that around if you put it at a distance from it.
Oh, alright. That's a good one. Oopsie.
Don't
cheat. Yeah, I don't think
really.
That doesn't work so much. Okay. Well, empirically, it doesn't work, but that doesn't mean shit. Okay. Here's one I made out of very, very thin wire. I wrapped it around a piece of rebar, which is just—it's actually steel, and steel is just kind of refined iron. And iron is known, compared to other elements, as having a very kind of—it has certain electromagnetic properties that allow it to be magnetized very heavily. It's as if kind of this theoretical magnetic fluid in Ampère's writings was very kind of loosely held inside that iron, atom. Why exactly, you know, what exactly is going on is more explained by what, you know, we've got with the moon model and more specifically. But, you know, this was a very interesting hypothesis. So what happens here is if I have a lot of windings, but the thinness of the wire actually prevents a lot of current from passing through. There's a certain amount of resistance. So one of the things that happens with this guy is that he gets kind of hot. But... okay. Oops, he's actually kind of weak. Alright, so even though I have more windings on this thing, it's actually getting kind of hot now. This wire is actually thicker, so it has, you know, if you might imagine it kind of like a pipe, you know, for water. The thicker the pipe, the more water can pass through at a, you know, given speed. What happens with the wire is that there is actually kind of the water is kind of getting held up, or maybe there's turbulence in it, and that energy is radiated out of the wire in the form of heat, and so it's not as efficient. So really you need a resistance free flow of electrons to make the electromagnet work. Now one of the other interesting things that I can do here is a property called induction, which is the ability to generate a current through a wire or through a piece of metal using just a magnet. So what I have here is okay, it's weird stuff happening up in Paso Robles or whatever. All right. So, this is something called a rare earth magnet. The reason that, you know, iron doesn't hold its electrical charge so well. If you've ever played with magnets, usually they kind of look like, you know, these black charcoal-y things. And they actually lose their charge over a while, but there's other metals that are called part of the rare earth series, the periodic table, that allow iron to actually retain some of its properties for a longer time. It's it's still probably only maybe, I don't know, say 30-40% of what iron could do if it was fully electrically charged. But, you know, it's like 30% efficiency. But still, these things are damn powerful. Now, what I can do here is I can... What I've done is I've plugged this up to measure the amount of... It's actually reading something. I have nothing going through this, and it's reading something. That's really annoying. All right, let's try a different setting. Okay, so on milliamps. That's a ghost in the machine. Oops. Wanna hold that? Thanks. Alright, so you just kind of see the number. Now, so I have the magnet, I kind of just run it across. Oops, I don't really want to touch it. It doesn't really matter. Oops, now I gotta get this on the side here. Alrighty. If I run it on the side, even if it touches, really nothing should really happen here. But once I move the magnet out to the front, so I should actually start getting a jump. Am I getting some current?
Yeah.
Oops. Even if I don't touch it, it should still work. And it's almost like kind of like, you know, I'm like pulling the magnetic fluid out the end of the, you know, this thing, and it appears that the current is actually going for a very short second. This property. This is the rate of flow of electrons coming through this wire. It's basically what amperage is. And so the unit used to measure the current going through is called the amp. The ampere, named after our very.
What is an amp?
I don't know what it's standardized against.
It is a coulomb per second, but.
Would you mean if you had a light bulb at the end of that, would the light bulb go?
I tried it with like very low voltage lights, and it actually didn't work. But I don't think I really have enough current. Yeah, that would be cool.
How many amps do you have in there right now?
Probably about 15 milliamps. Oh no, I'm actually generating like 3 milliamps. I just did 10 there, 20. So that was cheating. I actually touched it. Well, there's a relationship between the magnetic field and the electric flow, which is demonstrated using a strong magnet and this. This is actually measuring the electrical flow coming through these two wires, which are then wrapped around this piece of metal. Yeah. Because when this is just doing nothing, or even when I'm kind of going around the side of it, you know, I actually thought that it should do something when it's coming around the side, but it is? Oh, good. Very good. Let's try some of the different ones. Alright, this is on the outside. I have anything going? Oh, that works pretty good. Alright, now how about... Whoa, nearly. If I could somehow... Yeah, there's probably different things that we could test out, but that's basically the gist of it. Do I have something else I wanted to show? I did want to read you one part of one letter. This is actually, like I said, Gauss and Weber picked up on Ampere's work. And actually, the interesting thing was there was a significant amount of cross-Atlantic cooperation in the field of early electricity research, particularly around Ben Franklin. But this was a continuation of the Leibniz network preceding Ben Franklin's time, centered around, these Germans definitely were directly associated with the legacy of Leibniz, but also No, Franklin actually spoke to him. He read a lot of these papers, and he was in correspondence with these networks in Europe. By the time you get Joseph Henry at the time of Abraham Lincoln, who's involved with the development of the telegraph and these kinds of things, electrification projects. You had the steam engine about that time. Joseph Henry doesn't actually speak German. He doesn't really talk with these guys too much, but that was kind of the cross-pollination of ideas that gets reborn again pretty much around the same time as Lincoln and the steam engines and the railroad. So it is kind of interesting. Actually, one of the things I read that said that a lot of the stuff necessary for the telegraph was invented in Germany first. So it's unclear to me like what's going on. Some people say Joseph Henry. Some people say Sam Morse. The most reliable thing that I've heard is that Joseph Henry actually invented it. Sam Morse was involved in it, but actually the only thing he really invented was the Morse code. But I don't know, somebody.
There's also something of Gauss and Weber that they're involved in it.
Right.
They were the first ones to do that.
Let's see.
In Larry Heck's article, doesn't it mention that the first one established was between the astronomy department and the physics department at Göttingen?
I don't.
Is that Gauss and Weber?
Mm-hmm. That was the first one.
Okay, let's see. I don't want to read a bunch of these formulas, but what he's saying, so this is Gauss organizing Weber, and Weber's freaking out about ampere. I'm actually still unclear how to. I guess it's ampere. Ampere. I'm still unclear how to pronounce it. But Gauss says, I cannot contradict you when you pronounce Ampère's experiments to be not very conclusive. While, since I do not have Ampère's classic treatise at hand, nor do I recall the manner of his experiments at all. Nonetheless, I do not believe that Ampère, even if he himself were to admit the incompleteness of his experiments, would authorize the adoption of an entirely different formula, one whereby his entire theory would fall to pieces so long as this other formula were not reinforced by completely decisive experiments. You must have misunderstood the reservations which, according to your second letter, I myself have expressed. Early on I was convinced, and continued to be so, that the above-mentioned interchangeability necessarily requires the Ampere formula, and allows no other which is not identical with that one for a closed current if the effect is to occur in the direction of the straight lines connecting the two current elements. That, however, if one relinquishes the just expressed condition, one can choose countless other forms, which for a closed current must always give the same end result as Ampere's formula. And they go on talking about basically, is this valid? What's going on? It's it's kind of funny because what ends up happening out of this is that Gauss and Weber end up working very close together on trying to build some experiments that really nail down the question of, what actually is going on? Is this valid or not? And they decide to settle the question basically by going back into the work and trying to take it further. And they clearly succeed. That's basically the moral of the story. Yeah, I don't know what it is.
Well, I think we should go ahead and look at the
structure. Yeah. I don't know what it is.
Okay. I don't know.
Oh, region?
Yeah, go
ahead. Oh. I don't know if it was totally clear. I mean, do people...
Are you going to take questions later?
Yeah, at the end. Did people get what was happening, like, in this one with, you know, we were... No? Okay. Just to reiterate that, well, how it all started was you had, as Ed was saying, you had this fellow Ampere who was actually trying to really challenge the whole Newtonian, Aristotelian view of the universe, as Jason was going through in the introduction. The idea that, you know, you just have this empty space, it's an empty box with particles just sort of bumping into each other randomly. There's no order, there's no higher ordering principle to the universe. And so they have these very, you know, linear, statistical, algebraic equations. Like Lynn was saying this morning, that science is not a mathematical, it's not a manipulation of a mathematical formula, right? Science is a discovery of a principle. And so the Newtonians were not interested in principles. They were not interested in actually finding out the causes for anything happening. They were just interested, as Jason and then our friends Tycho Brahe and Kepler were noticing last night, that they were just interested in observing phenomenon and reporting on what they were observing and maybe manipulating some of that information, but never actually going into what's really going on. And so Ampere came along, and Larry was making the point that, you know, this is actually really crucial from the standpoint of both the political battle that has gone on in history and the political battle that we're in today, that we're waging today, because every scientific discovery is a political intervention into history. You know, I mean, it's no accident that most of the great scientists were assassinated, right? Pythagoras, you know, Socrates, Lavoisier, actually, who Danny just touched on, was beheaded during the French Revolution. So Ampere was actually doing these discoveries under a fascist dictatorship, much like we're trying to do our discoveries under a Cheney fascist dictatorship. And so he was, as Ed was starting to go through, that he actually was taking... He had to be somewhat a little more subtle. Kepler, you see it much more rigorously. I mean, he just comes right out through the discussion of his method and says, you know, this is what's wrong with the Newtonian method. This is how I'm going to totally overturn it, through his discoveries in what Jason already went through in the orbits of the planets, et cetera, and the positions of the planets. But this idea that... Again, that you're actually looking for a principle. And so what Ampere does is he goes about it by first couching what he's saying, sounding as though he's coming from a Newtonian standpoint, actually using their own terms, but then completely revolutionizing it. And so to make a long story short, because we don't have a lot of time to go through it very in depth, but what he said, the Newtonian law of forces between currents was just that if you had these two parallel currents, that as Ed went through, if they were going in the same direction, they would attract. If they were going in opposite directions, they would repel. Just that was the beginning and the end of it. And there was the same force law, like for the forces between two planets, right? It's called the inverse square law. People have heard this. If you have like one planet times the other planet divided by the square of the distance between the two planets, that's your force. And so Ampere comes along and says, no, that's total bullshit. You know, I mean, first of all, you haven't proved that. You're just asserting it and then extrapolating it for the entire universe. And so what he does through some of these, what seem like very simple experiments, right? I mean, this took us not very long. Got to give our props to Ardina Clark there in the background, who helped us with the, and Sky, who helped do this one. But, you know, we're basically what Ampere was doing was trying to investigate this idea of what's actually happening, A, with electricity, B, with magnetism, and these so-called statistical forces, what's actually happening. And so what he showed is that the whole point of this is that you have this, as we saw, you could have plastic, you could have a piece of metal, but you're wrapping around these coils of a circuit. And actually, the more coils, we should have tried it out with one that didn't have as many. I think we did have one that had less coils around. And then this one, we just really wound it, you know, coil upon coil upon coil. And what you see is the more coils, yeah, we did one with just a few coils, and then we did one with a lot. And with the one with a lot of the coils, what you see is that you're actually inducing a magnetic charge. You know, before, when we didn't have the electricity running through here, this was had no magnetic charge to it. We couldn't pick up the scissors, right? But as soon as we hook it up to an electric current, all of a sudden you're seeing the this thing being charged. And the more coils you actually wrap around this, the stronger the magnet. And so what Ampere actually starts looking at is the fact that electricity and magnetism are actually the same thing, right? And this is actually the first hypothesis, the reason why we're going through Ampere, Gauss, and Weber in the same subject as the moon model of the nucleus, is this is what led to atomic science. I mean, we're all kind of assuming that, you know, we know about atoms, we know about neutrons and protons and electrons. This was like, not, they didn't even have like those words, let alone a concept of what those things were, right? So they were just trying to investigate matter, investigate the universe. You know, Mendeleev was later, but so he comes up with this hypothesis that actually electricity and magnetism are the same thing, and you have these electric, what he kind of called electric molecules. He didn't call them electrons. Some sort of charged molecules that were rotating around within this material that once the current was running through, it was actually aligning the charge and creating, everybody knows, a magnet, creating a north pole and a south pole, creating this charge. So these different experiments that he was doing, both with the solenoid experiment, with the parallel wire experiment, where he saw that if you have these two parallel wires, they attract if they're going in the same direction, repulse if they're in the different opposite direction, that this whole idea that you just have these two parallel forces was wrong, because he said, well, unfortunately I didn't get a chance to make transparencies for this one, but if you see them parallel, right, what happens if they're at an angle to each other, or if they're longitudinal? Imagine if you have two current wires parallel, right, but then I move this one and now it's at a certain angle to the second current wire, or I move it longitudinal to the second current wire. Now what's the force? Well, according to Newton, you can't really measure it. We have no way of empirically seeing it, so we have no idea, so ignore it, right? Just look at these parallel forces. And, of course, you know, a real scientist is not going to sit and take that. So he started doing these experiments and actually found out that there is a change, that actually there is what he called an angular force, that you can't just look at it as two parallel forces. And then he went on, then what Ed started going through, then what Gauss, and so he was, this just turned the whole Newtonian science world on its, I mean, there were massive freakouts. Ampere was, you know, slandered, written out of the history books for the, you know, in large part. And it wasn't until Gauss and Weber later on came along and said, no, there's something to this. We actually have to do, and by then they were able to do a lot more rigorous experiments to actually prove without a shadow of a doubt that Ampere was right. And that's what they went ahead and did, came up with this idea of not just an angular force, but what's called a relative velocity, that you have these, the velocities are relative to each other if they're going parallel in a certain way, and they're relative to each other in a different way if they're longitudinal. And so you do have to take this into account. And this, again, this was a huge uproar. You had these guys, Grassmann, Maxwell, you know, completely attacking Weber. And actually, the interesting thing about the part of the letter that Ed read is that Weber somewhat capitulated to the attack. He actually wrote, there was a series of correspondences between Gauss and Weber. And Weber wrote a letter to Gauss saying, I'm going to ignore Ampere. I'm going to only look at the parallel forces. I'm not going to look at the longitudinal component. And the thing that Larry was saying is really a crucial intervention into history, without which we wouldn't have the history of atomic science. We wouldn't have what we know as nuclear power, the potential for fusion energy. Gauss writes this letter to Weber, and basically in so many words says, get your head out of your rear end. You're totally capitulating to popular opinion. And it kind of made me think of how recently Lynn's come out saying to like the economics staff in particular, I don't want to hear any more in the briefing about Alan Greenspan and what he says about the economy. We're not here making commentary on, a fantasy world, right? We're here to prove a principle, the principle that we know and that we represent in the universe, is really the only movement right now in the world that represents that principle. So Weber intervenes in this, or Gauss rather intervenes on Weber, and thank God he did, because Weber basically founded atomic science from that point on. Weber actually comes in and kind of like apologizes. He kind of like realizes he's being a total schmuck. He's like, yeah, you're right. I kind of wimped out there for a minute, but thanks for smacking me out of it. And then goes on to come up with the first hypothesis of the electron radius, the first hypothesis of what's called a binding force, or now it's called the Coulomb force, which is what binds the nucleus together, which is what, again, led into things like the discovery of fission, nuclear fission and fusion, which only, maybe 100 years later, in the 1920s and 30s, we were actually to have a much more rigorous proof. But he was already hypothesizing this without, again, things like, microscopes and things like that. So this was a revolution. And so these experiments, like we say, they might seem like, oh yeah, you wrapped a wire around a piece of metal and, whoop-de-doo, But I mean, this is why we're all here today, and with 6 billion people alive on the planet and potential for billions more.
Can you go over that angular force thing again? I think quite
different. Yeah, I don't know how much time.
Maybe
let me save it for the Q&A, because I haven't even... The problem is we haven't even started talking about the moon model, which is the title of this. But hand me that up. That was supposed to be the segue into going through the electromagnetic stuff, going into now what we're here to investigate, which is this moon model, the nucleus. And I know a lot of people, when I kept hearing the term the moon model, is like, oh, does something to do with like the moon and Adam, and wow, it kind of sounds interesting. But no, it's actually a reference, and again, I don't know if anybody's going to be able to see this.
No, because the circuit breaks.
Oh, this doesn't even work.
No.
Okay. Well, I could try passing it around or something.
And Marty, can you put the overhead in there? And the other end of it, too.
The reason why it's called the moon model... Is it working?
It will in a second.
Oh. Well, I'll show you a picture of him. It's kind of a funny guy. He kind of, as somebody once said, they went to a meeting that he was speaking at, and they were like, wow, it's Ben Franklin. you can't really see it. But he's got this long white hair, these glasses. And people can see later on tonight.
I noticed that if you take that whiteboard and put it much closer.
Oh, yeah?
It shows
what whiteboard?
Up very nicely. There's a big whiteboard that we're using.
Oh, you mean project it onto the whiteboard?
Yeah. If you want to show it, if you don't, you don't.
Well, it would help because a lot of these are going to...
Oh, wow.
You're going to... Oh, yeah. There you go, Phil. Should you put it on a... Phil, to the rescue! Okay. But we need to erase.
This isn't really a whiteboard marker.
But I don't think that's a racer.
You have to
wet it.
Okay.
All right. We're going to keep it moving. We don't want to leave Ouyang in the lurch. All right. That's Dr. Moon. And he's a really amazing guy. You should all get to know his mind, hopefully by... And I should preface this also with, this is all like very works in progress. I mean, literally, like, not only are we just ourselves barely looking into this, people doing this presentation, but just human knowledge about the atom and the nucleus and what's really going on is extraordinarily limited. And as Danny was pointing out, I mean, we really, and Larry said this, and I hadn't really thought about it in this way until he said it, is that like the people in this, at this cadre school and in this organization, like we are more on the cutting edge of science right now than any professor at MIT or, you know, some big wig, Stephen Hawking, as you pointed out last night, that because it's a question of method. You know, these guys might have all the greatest equipment and, you know, tons of money and quote-unquote prestige, a couple Nobel Prizes, but they have no idea how to actually, as Ed was saying, how do you know that you know something is true? They have no sense of a method, an epistemology for seeking truth. And, I mean, one of my contacts is works at the UCLA Cancer Research Lab, and he just came up to me one day and was like, we're never going to find a cure for cancer. I mean, he knows that the method that they're using, I think he's discovered this the more he's been around us, but he just realized at a certain point that they don't really even have an intention to find a cure. You know, that they're studying a dead process to try to understand a living process, which doesn't work. But the interesting thing, so, I mean, people should get really, I mean, the main thing that Larry Heck, people don't know who Larry is the guy who wrote, who collaborated with Dr. Moon, wrote a lot of the articles on the moon model, and he's really trying to get, you know, young people excited about collaborating and doing this work, be it on the moon model, be it on this electromagnetic stuff, but really being at the, really seeing ourselves, as Danny said, as the next generation of scientists who are going to make new discoveries that have yet to be made. But that's the way Dr. Moon always saw himself. In fact, one day he was out with his dad, and the car broke down. You know, he grew up in the Midwest on a farm, and the car broke down, so his dad went off to, you know, try to get some supplies to fix it. And when his dad came back, the car was running. And his dad was like, what's going on here? And he goes, oh, yeah, there was just a wiring that was loose. And, you know, maybe, okay, he's a smart kid. The thing was, he was 5 years old. So imagine you leave your five-year-old kid your broken-down car and come back 10 minutes later and it's running. So they knew they were dealing with with a special person. And then at the age of 10, he became very well-known in the neighborhood for being able to fix everybody's car. So he was running. The child labor services showed up at his house because they were concerned that they heard about, you know, this young kid being forced, you know, to do hard labor at an auto mechanic shop. And they came to the house, and then they see this 10-year-old kid there, and he goes, oh, no, don't worry, I'm the owner and the manager, and I do all the work. So I work for myself, so, you know, there's nobody that you could actually prosecute for making me work. So they were very impressed. They went away without taking anyone off to prison. But I think the reason why I bring up these kind of anecdotes is that, I mean, you really get this sense of what LaRouche says every child should be. If we were in, I mean, keep in mind he's passed away now in 89, but he was of the generation of LaRouche, this World War II generation. And, you know, as Lynn has said, it wasn't quite as destroyed. I mean, they had problems, but it wasn't quite a destroyed society as it is today. You know, whereas now, you know, you think it's cool if some five-year-old little kid can, like, rap all the words to, you know, some Eminem song or something, or sing a Mariah Carey song, you know. I mean, literally, you know, they have these shows with, like, little kids, and they get up there and, like, tap dance or something, and everybody, and, you know, and I mean, there's just something horribly wrong that, you know, in the time of Mozart, you know, he was five, and he was composing music and playing string quartets with his dad's friends, you know, when he was five, and that wasn't, I mean, it was remarkable, but we want to create a renaissance where that just is, like, the norm. You know, where every child is going to be a genius and grow up to be an even more developed genius, as you see with Moon. And he has always had this, as LaRouche always says, always ask the question why. Always wanted to figure out not just what's happening, but why it's happening. And so he was constantly, you know, at a young age, you know, fixing things, doing chemistry experiments, investigating how the telescopes, radio equipment, He had already graduated college at the age of 17 from the University of Missouri, and then he basically decided that he wanted to go into not only nuclear chemistry, but actually solve the problem of nuclear thermonuclear fusion. And this was back in 1929, before, you know, we didn't even have nuclear fission at that point, but he was already thinking, you know, way ahead of his time. So he went to the University of Chicago, worked with a fellow named William Draper Harkins, who was actually, I don't know a whole lot about him, but apparently he was the first one to conceive of the idea of a neutron. And he also fought this idea, which I guess I'm going to have to draw it, this idea of probably most of us heard about the Bohr model of the nucleus, right? Bohr, Rutherford, no, yes, maybe. I'll just draw it and then I'll... It's just a very, I mean, if you take any, like, physics, chemistry, I mean, this is what they teach you. I mean, this is the way I was taught. And now that I think about it, it's pretty pathetic. But at the time, I was just like, okay, that's the way the atom works. But, you know, you just have this idea that you have a nucleus with some protons in the middle there, right? And then you have these electron shells going around it with these negatively charged, right? And they go from these different orbitals and so forth. But already this guy, William Draper Harkins, realized again that this had no real understanding of what they were looking at. It was just a very, obviously, you can see, very flat. And when we go to the moon model, you'll see why this is so fatally flawed. But that it was just a very flat, linear view, and it really didn't tell you anything about what was actually going on inside the atom or the nucleus. And so he actually ended up with two doctorates, Dr. Moon, in physics and chemistry. He went on to build the second cyclotron in the world in 1936, which is apparently some kind of machine where they have high-speed atoms, you know, crashing into each other and can do various experiments and so forth. He also, and he improved upon the first one that was built. I mean, all of this, keep in mind, he's like, you know, 20 years old when he's doing all of this stuff. And he was recruited to work on the Manhattan Project. People know what that was. The Manhattan Project was when I'm not going to go through the whole history on this, but this was during World War II when people like Russell and so forth were promoting the idea that, oh, the Germans are going to build the nuclear bomb, so America has to build the nuclear bomb first, you know, to get a head start. And somehow they were able to manipulate and convince Roosevelt that that was actually happening. But so they started work on the Manhattan Project, and one of the key things that Dr. Moon did on this was he solved the problem of what's called the carbon moderator, where people know how nuclear fusion or fission works, rather. You have to hit a uranium atom with a very slow-moving neutron, and then the neutron shatters the uranium and lets off neutrons, which lets off a tremendous amount of heat, which is where you're getting, you know, this tremendous amount of energy in a nuclear reaction. But they were having a problem where apparently carbon is able to slow down the neutron, and they were having a problem with how they were positioning it, and apparently he actually solved this. So he was crucial in actually developing nuclear power. And obviously after Bertrand Russell and others had the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, I mean, most of these scientists were completely devastated. I mean, never in their wildest dreams did they imagine that, you know, we were actually going to be dropping these bombs, especially on people that had already surrendered. You know, Japan had already surrendered, essentially. But what he ended up doing was mobilizing then to create, to use nuclear power as, you know, a form of energy, you know, as non-military use, but for civilian use. And he went on also to do biophysics research. He built the world's first scanning X-ray microscope in 1949. And he met the LaRouche movement in 1974 in Chicago. And apparently he was actually the one who introduced us to this Weber work and introduced us to this paper by really emphasized the importance of his discovery and introduced us to the sixth memoir of Weber, where he goes through these key discoveries in Ampere's work and so forth. And but the key change, which Ed kind of started off with, was when he was really influenced to rigorously study LaRouche's writings, philosophical and scientific writings. He had always kind of been on supporting what we were doing politically, but had never done a real rigorous work through of LaRouche's ideas themselves. And although he was the editor-in-chief of what used to be, it's now our 21st Century magazine, it used to be the Fusion magazine. And so at a certain point, he actually went, I think this was in 1984, and just did a, decided to do a very rigorous study, reading through LaRouche's writings, reading through, he also, apparently, he introduced us to Weber, and we introduced him to Kepler. I think he knew of Kepler, but he had not read rigorously Kepler's writings. So he read the Mysterium Cosmographicum, where, as Jason went through at the beginning, he lays out this relationship of these Platonic solids with the planetary orbits. And, you know, this apparently, you know, after a few days of really working through this and thinking about it, he came up with what we now call the moon model of the nucleus, where he said, basically, look, if these solids, and again, you know, there's a lot of people who can go through this with people if you're not familiar with it more in depth, but, I mean, this is a principle. People have heard of this idea of the least action principle in the universe, that everything in the universe operates on this idea of least action. Right? You see it in, I think some people have gone through this with things like reflection and refraction, right? That you actually start seeing that light is actually operating in a least action principle, not of what was originally thought of least distance, but actually of least time. Or something like the catenary chain, where this hangs in a least action curvature. And so you see it everywhere in the universe, and so the ancient Greeks saw it that this was a least action principle of dividing a sphere into these five Platonic solids. And then Kepler seeing, well, if there's only five ways to equally divide a sphere, that's giving us an indication of the shape of space, an indication of that, again, the universe is not just an empty box with particles bumping into each other, but that there is some kind of order, there is some sort of bounding principle. And so what Moon's discovery was seeing that, well, there's one universe. There's not the macrocosm, right, the astronomical universe, and then the cosm, which is what we see here, that's another separate universe, and then there's another separate universe, the microcosm. There's one universe. And so these principles adhere to the entire universe, not just, you know, certain aspects of it. So he said if it works in the macrocosm, it should also explain what's going on in the microcosm. And so this is where, and everybody, I think most people here are familiar with the idea of the periodic table of elements. Yes, no, maybe?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right, this idea that, actually, Ouyang is going to be going into somewhat more in depth. Can I stick this in this water?
Yeah, a little bit.
But this idea that, again, this gives you into a sense of a bounding of space, that there's an actual order to how these elements behave, right? Where typically you see the elements that are in the same columns have a lot of the same physical characteristics, interact similarly as each other. And as I'll go through, then you also see certain relationships with the periods as you go along the rows. And a lot of this has been unexplained. I mean, Mendeleev was able to observe these phenomenon and order them, but it was still not totally clear why they were behaving the way they were behaving, why certain elements reacted the way they did, what their relationships were to each other. And this Bohr model, like I said earlier, gave you absolutely no indication or explanation of what these relationships were. It was very linear. It was just this idea that, you know, hydrogen, it's got one electron, one proton, right? One neutron, one proton. Then you go to the next one. Helium, you add another proton, right? Another electron. Then lithium, so this has an atomic number of 2. Lithium has an atomic number of 3, and you're just adding on these linear addition of protons, right? But there's no sense of a geometry of space. There's no sense of a principle of why that's happening. And so what Moon does with his discovery, and I'm going to run through this kind of quick because I want to make sure Ouyang has time. But, I mean, people, you know, we're going to be around. We're going to be working and doing more classes on this over time. So if any of this is not clear or people have questions, you know, we can discuss it over the weekend and throughout the work that we're doing. But he starts, as we said earlier, with looking at this idea of the Platonic solids. right? And saying, okay, in the way that Kepler, actually I have the picture of Kepler, in the way that Kepler had this inscribing of the Platonic solids with the orbits, right, with the sphere and then the orbits inside the sphere and the solid, he said, well, what would happen if we actually started looking at it from the standpoint of looking at the atomic nucleus and see if we can see some sort of correlation? And maybe the fastest way to present it. But, well, let's just first look at what he saw with the nesting. Is Tom Rooney around? Can someone ask him to bring down his nested... he actually built a nice model of the nesting, because I don't think this... Yeah, but, well, I kind of wanted people to see. You can kind of see the picture of it. And then there's this one here. But yeah, this is exactly what he did. He nested, and we can pass this around, but be gentle. It's already gotten kind of bent up. But what he... Okay, I've been told I can't pass around. You can come up and look at it afterwards. But, so he starts with what are called the duals, which are the cube and the octahedron. And what that is, if I can find a picture. People can see, for example, that the cube can nest pretty much perfectly symmetrically inside the octahedron. I don't know where my transparency is for that one. Oh, here. You can see here that the octahedron can nest perfectly where all of its vertices are perfectly at the midpoint of the plane of the cube. People see that? Okay. And then you can see, unfortunately these pictures didn't come out very well, but you can also see that the cube, the vertices of the cube also lie at the midpoints of all the faces of the plane of the octahedron, right? So he calls these duals, that they have this perfectly symmetrical relationship with each other. Now, the icosahedron and dodecahedron also have this relationship, where the midpoint, the vertices of the, oh, thanks, the vertices of the dodecahedron are perfectly at the midpoint of the faces of the icosahedron. I don't know, if you want to fear, if you don't fear the wrath of Tom Rooney, then you can try to. Yeah, he built that, and I don't know how happy he'd be if it got ruined. So, but people can come up and look at it. But you just see the nesting of the cube inside the octahedron, and then you see the nesting of the same thing, like I said, these are duals. The icosahedron, all the vertices of the icosahedron fit perfectly into the midpoints of the faces of the dodecahedron. So you have these duals, and then the tetrahedron is what he calls a dual to itself, that you can fit a smaller tetrahedron in that same relationship into the larger tetrahedron. And there is a significance to why the tetrahedron is dual to itself, and which I'll go through in a minute. But so you can see the cube and the octahedron dual. You can see the dodecahedron and the icosahedron dual. But what about if I wanted to put an octahedron inside an icosahedron? Anybody who doesn't already know the answer know how we could possibly do that? The icosahedron and the... This is the icosahedron. This is the octahedron. So we know that the cube and the octahedron are duals and fit symmetrically. And we know that the decahedron and icosahedron are duals and are symmetric. But now we're looking at the octahedron and the icosahedron. And
we're fit the octahedron inside the icosahedron?
We want to fit this inside this. So. Well, I don't know if you... Yeah, you could look at it. It's not necessarily obvious. I mean... But you could, if you looked at it and you knew something about geometry, you might be able to figure it out. But anyway, what he figured out, Moon figured out, is that going back to our good friend, the golden mean proportion, that if you somewhat skew the position. If I have the picture here. If you skew the positioning, where you can take the six vertices of the octahedron and place them at a golden mean proportion of one of the triangles. They'll go on six of the triangles of the icosahedron. That it will actually fit. Can people see where Ouyang is holding it up? No?
So I think this is the golden, right? Between here.
He's got the floss, keeps it on the line.
Well, actually, you can see it here. This, although Joe said she might have been a little bit off, but this is actually, I should also give credit to Joe McAndrews from Australia. She built this. But what he's doing is he's putting the octahedron at a golden section proportion in one of the faces of the icosahedron. And if people remember what this golden section is, it's this idea that A is to B, as B is to this whole length. B is to A plus B.
So it's a perpendicular going down from the vertices to the base of the triangle?
Right.
Yeah.
Say this relationship? Okay. It's the idea that if you take the six vertices of the octahedron and you place them in six of the faces of the icosahedron at a position which is a golden mean proportion between in this relationship on this triangle, which people saw what Jason did with the golden mean idea, the idea that A is to B as B is to A plus B, that you see that in every living thing. Like if you look at the human body, I think it's like from your head to your stomach, if you called that A, and then your stomach to your feet would be B, that A would be to B as B is to the length of your whole body, right? And that in all living things, you see this golden mean proportion, golden mean growth ratio. And so, Moon, really, I don't know how he figured all this stuff out, but you know, it was the method of studying Lind, studying Kepler, and understanding these principles. And so again, in something that, I mean, this just you see shadows, and Ed and I were talking about this earlier, of how sometimes even without the physical experiment per se, you know that something is right as a principle because you see it reflected. I mean, this is more than a coincidence, right? That all of a sudden in this moon model, you're seeing all of these things come out. This principle of life, this growth ratio of the divine proportion. You also see it. I mean, you see it in the relationship of the. If you call in this inscribed system, if you call the edge of your cube one, the relationship of the edge of your cube to the edge of your dodecahedron is the golden mean proportion. Yeah. Yipperoonie. So it's pretty cool. And so, you know, these were things where Moon was seeing this and going, okay, maybe I'm really onto something here. And so he has this, first of all, this idea of these nested solids. Then he gets into this idea of, okay, and again, this is just the nucleus. This is not even talking about the electrons, because when we had these discussions with Larry, we were asking him, you know, well, what about the electrons? You know, you always hear these things about electron shells and orbitals, and you learn about these spins, and you do all this, really, which just ends up being a lot of manipulation of formulas in these physics classes, chemistry classes. But what Moon had told Larry when Larry asked him the same question is, the only way you're ever going to understand what's happening with the electrons is if first you actually understand what's happening in the nucleus. That's the generating principle. So you got to master that, and then you can actually start looking outward. So that's what he does, is he starts looking at the nucleus itself, which is, you know, the protons and the neutrons. And initially he just looks at the protons. And actually it's Larry who eventually comes up with a theory on what you would do with the neutrons. But what he does, and I'm going to... is he looks at... this is carbon. And carbon has... six protons and six neutrons. And actually, let's look at the oxygen one down here because he's got all of them drawn in. The oxygen, you have... Okay. Sorry. I probably just made it worse. But can people see that in the back or not? Just put it higher. Okay. What he has here is the atom, the oxygen nucleus, okay? And what you see is oxygen has eight protons. It's also got eight neutrons. So what he's doing is he's placing these protons, right? You've got how many vertices are on a cube? Anyone?
Eight.
Yeah. So there's eight vertices on a cube. And how many, okay. And so what he sees is if you put these protons on the eight vertices and then you put the neutrons, well, actually I kind of skipped something. Remember our tetrahedron? Our tetrahedron dual? You can't forget the tetrahedron. It does actually fit on here. So this is what's called, anyone know what an alpha particle is? Yeah, it's a nucleus of a helium atom, which has two protons and two neutrons. And so what he does is he takes this alpha particle as the smaller tetrahedron, which has these four vertices on the tetrahedron, and puts puts two protons on there and two neutrons on the tetrahedron vertices. And then from there, he then puts the alpha particle inside the two tetrahedrons inside the cube. So what happens by the time you get to oxygen, because you have the eight protons on the vertices of the cube, you have the eight neutrons. Well, where he just, and this is Larry's contribution, is Larry says, we're going to put, because he saw what Moon did with the protons, and he said, well, this makes sense, it's lawful, but there's still no explanation for the neutrons, and if we're going to actually believe in this idea that there's an ordering principle to space, it's not just a random haphazard accident, there's got to be some sort of explanation for what's also happening with the neutrons. And so he started looking at the neutrons, looking at the edges of the solids, because earlier the protons were just dealing with the vertices. He starts looking at the edges, and this is kind of interesting because it starts getting into not just the platonic solids, but was later known as the Archimedean solids. And again, these pictures are really horrible, but you know, when you have a solid, you have something called the circumsphere, which is the sphere that surrounds the solid. You also have the insphere, which is a sphere that would lie perfectly inside it. And then you have something called the midsphere. I think I have a picture of that. And if you look at the midsphere of a cube, where is it? If you look at the midsphere of a cube, this is a circumsphere, right? You see the vertices each touch the edges of the sphere. The midsphere, the sphere touches each of the faces of the plane. The insphere, rather, touches the faces of the planes of the cube. And then the midsphere intersects the edges, the midpoint of the edges of the cube. And from that, if you connect these edges, you get what's called a cube octahedron, which is an Archimedean solid. Yeah. And... So basically, he does this with the midsphere. You get a cube octahedron, when you have the midsphere of a cube or an octahedron, and you get a icosadodecahedron, if you have it a midsphere between in a icosahedron or a dodecahedron. And so what ends up happening is the neutrons are actually in the positions of these Archimedean solids.
Is that how you get all the Archimedean solids that way?
Through these midspheres? Yeah. I'm not sure if you can. I know that's how you can get those too. Johnny Martinez might be able to answer how you get the rest of them. But I'm not sure about that.
There's more than five.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, that's true.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. So he takes these neutrons and starts placing them at these positions of the Archimedean solids, and then the protons in the positions of the platonic solids, the vertices. And so we were looking at our oxygen. Where we have our protons on all the vertices, we have our neutrons on all the midpoints of the edges of the tetrahedron, right? And which also happens to be the midpoint of the center of the plane, the face rather, of the cube. And this actually, the reason why, like for example, if you go back to the periodic table itself, and you start looking at, you know, certain things that are going on, like this is one of the things I thought was really fascinating. Because, I always was interested in the periodic table, but who was it? Somebody was telling me that when they literally, like, walked out of their chemistry class, never to be interested in chemistry again, was when their teacher just made them memorize this entire thing, you know? And that is a good way to kill any passion for, like, I mean, when you actually start seeing these as geometries, and actually Anna had read one of Larry's article on this, and she got, you know, really excited about the way that he put this, that you actually start looking at every element as like a singularity, almost like a personality, that it actually, instead of just a linear addition of protons, of one more proton or one more electron, it's actually a complete transformation of the curvature of the universe, right? With each change in this structure. And I was kind of thinking of it like you wouldn't just say, oh yeah, I just had one more kid. You know, I had 9 kids and now I've got 10. And it's just like another number, you know. I mean, you would actually see each child as an infinite potential to change the universe, right? And so if you think about it in those ways, then, you know, this actually becomes, like Lynn was saying today, it's a living personality. And you actually want to get to know how these things are actually working in the universe. It's not dead at all. It's actually fascinating. And some of the things we're going to start doing is like growing crystals, looking at different elements, and really invest. Because as Larry is saying, it's one thing to read it out of a textbook, but when you're actually doing these experiments and you're like Larry, we would get these reports from Jason as he was doing this electrolysis thing, you know, where we were like, okay, is he going to be on the call next week, or is he going to have blown himself up by then? You know, he's like lighting gas and like making explosions and like hooking up car batteries. But, you know, it's that excitement of the experimental process and really getting your hands on to make a discovery yourself, as Lynn keeps emphasizing, not just learning what the discovery was and sort of memorizing it and plugging it out in a multiple choice test. But you don't know it until you've relived that discovery in your own mind. And that's a real education, which unfortunately is not, I think probably most people who are still in the unfortunate circumstance of still being enrolled at a university, know you're this is not the method that's being employed there to develop your mind. So I'll just sum it up because I know Ouyang has some important things to say. There's a lot more that could be said. I mean, the main last thing to say about this periodic table, which I think is fascinating, is that if you look at the cube, the cube is oxygen. In other words, all of the vertices of the cube will be filled with the 8 protons of oxygen. And all of the vertices of the icosahedron and the cube, octahedron and the cube, would be silicon, which would be, I think, it's 14 protons. Then, now silicon and oxygen, I think it's oxygen makes up about 60% of all of the Earth's crust, and then silicon makes up about 20%. So between silicon and oxygen, you're talking about 80% of what makes up the Earth's crust. Now you might, now up until this moon model, there was absolutely no real explanation why that was. It was just sort of like one of those things that just, it's there. We don't know why. Well, all of a sudden, it makes a hell of a lot of sense, because the cube, when it's got all eight protons, the icosahedron, when it's got all of its vertices with protons, is a very stable structure, right? It's not, if there was only four protons in the cube, there'd be four vertices that there was nothing there, and so it would be unstable. Things would be either attracted to it or repelled to it to try to fill up those vertices. And so what's happening, the reason why you're seeing these very abundant elements is they're the most stable, which are explained by this moon model. And then the next one, the full shell of the icosahedron, is iron, which has an interesting thing. It's not, apparently as you go, the more up the periodic table you go, I think the amount of its presence in the universe goes down. In other words, the higher the atomic number, the less of it is in the universe. But iron is something like three times more abundant than any of the other elements around it. So
it's 5% by weight of Earth's crust.
Right. And then it's 5% by weight of the iron, Jason was saying, is 5% by weight of the Earth's crust. And then the full dodecahedron would bring us to, where is it here? Palladium, which is 46, which I can't see anything on this thing. Yeah, right there. Palladium. And then I think he was saying, isn't iron also the end product of fusion? It's one of the end products of fusion.
It's also very magnetic.
It's also very magnetic, yeah. Like he said that most of the sun, even though they say most of the sun is helium, it's actually mostly iron. That's what Larry was saying. It's kind of cool. But so then you get to this idea of palladium, right, which is your completed dodecahedron, and then I'll just finish this up. The idea that he continues this on, there's 92 naturally occurring elements, ending with uranium.
You're on it.
Yeah, right there. And the rest, I guess, are man-made or, yeah. So you've got 92 naturally occurring elements. So you're saying, well, okay, we filled up all of these proton shells, but we only have gotten to 46 protons. So what's up with that, right? Where's the other half? Where's the other 46? Well, lo and behold, Moon has this idea of what he calls the dual, or the what you would have is two of these dodecahedrons, then linking, right? Then you start having, I think the next one is then silver. Next atomic number after palladium is silver. So you keep adding. So first you would add up, but I won't get into that. I'm running out of time, but. So what happens is this then fills up the icosahedron shell. Then it actually goes in before it fills up it fills up the dodecahedron, the icosahedron. Then it goes in and fills up the octahedron and the cube. But then I think that still only takes you to atomic. That ends up taking you to this noble gas, krypton. You still have three. Six more elements, which do not have any place to go now on this model. So what he says then has to happen with your twin dodecahedras, you can see how first they're together like this, these pentagons, breaks apart, and now they're only being held together by this hinge, right? So that just opened up a place for three more protons, right? Four more?
Yeah, because when the faces move together,
uh-huh.
There's an icosahedron.
Oh, right. Yeah. So, yeah, now there's another spot on the icosahedron. That's right. And then, so that gets you up to the next four, francium, radium, thorium, thorium. But then you still have, what was 91 called, PA?
Protactinium.
So with the protactinium, which has 91, this thing's falling apart on me. We can fix this. So then with the protactinium, the hinge itself now breaks. Now it's literally hanging by just this one little thing here. And so that opens it up for one more. And then finally, we're at uranium. Now, what the heck is going to happen with uranium, right? It's only hanging by this one thing. So he says that it somewhat shifts a bit, you know, maybe something like this, so that there is another spot for a proton to go. But the point being, this also then explains what up until the moon model had no explanation, which is thermonuclear, which is fission, the fission of the uranium atom. Because this is an extraordinarily unstable, it's not even hanging by any kind of a hinge at all. It's just very, you know, unstably sort of positioned in there. And so you can imagine as your slow-moving neutron, right, comes in, hits this thing. I mean, this thing is just waiting to bust apart. And you've got nuclear fission energy. So, but the interesting thing of this all is what has yet to be done, which is that, Lynn, I think people have known by now, has said that the real breakthrough we need to make is fusion energy, which is actually the power of the sun, right? Hydrogen being turned into helium, which is what's happening in the sun. And I thought it was interesting because I was thinking that somebody had actually been asking me, I think it was Matthew, like, well, I want to learn more about how fusion works and what do we need to do to figure out, you know, these problems. And I was thinking, I don't know either. We should start looking into it. And then we started working on this moon model, just not even realizing they were necessarily related. And Larry was saying that Lynn is saying that the solution to solving the problem of fusion energy is the moon model of the nucleus. Because how can we figure out how to fuse two nucleuses together if we don't even know what's going on inside the nucleus, you know? And right when you're fusing these two hydrogen atoms together to create helium. So this is, literally, when we say this is the cutting edge of science right now, where we need to be, it's this moon model. And Larry, a lot of these are still, this is the first paper that Larry wrote, which was called, people want to look this up because I know we went through a lot of this very quickly, and there's a lot more in here that I haven't even touched on. But the article is called The Geometric Basis for the Periodicity of the Elements by Larry Hecht from, I think it was the October 88, 21st century. And he says a little thing, Mysterium Microcosmicum. So like, off of Kepler's Mysterious Cosmographicum. But, I'll basically end it there. But I do, as I like to do, end everything with a quote from Mr. LaRouche. Because Larry had sent me this thing that I guess LaRouche wrote back in 97. I don't know. I think it was something out of the briefing or if it was a paper. But there were just a couple quotes in there which I thought really summed up this idea of the passion that's required for Moon to have been able to make these breakthroughs and then for us to be able to pick up where Moon has left off and continue his work. So just basically like two paragraphs, but the first one is under the heading, My Unique Role. LaRouche says, the importance that I have in contrast to the lesser importance of the organization as a whole has internationally lies in the fact that I represent ideas. This is a time when suggestions, propositions, designs, programs, etc. mean very little relative to the generative quality of ideas. Not plans, not representations, not schemas, but principles, the communication of principles, the contrast of good principles to bad principles, the contrast of being a people to being an ogre. That's what's important. And since I do that better virtually than anyone else that you know, therein lies the particular importance of my role in this period of history, which is a great burden to me, because I still am a mortal being with certain limitations, and those limitations press hard upon me at times. And my problem, therefore, is that fewer of you than should be are measuring up to that same standard which I satisfy, and my hope is that more of you will rise to that level. And then he goes on to say, under the topic of the mission of truth-seeking in science, he says, "This is all the work of Bob Moon, in the sense that not that it was all original to him, but Bob Moon was the person among us, deceased in 89, a highly distinguished figure of American 20th century science, who we must honor. Because by honoring him, we are honoring morally an indebtedness to ideas. And to the people who play a leading role in fostering their development. To me, just like the work I proposed, which is being carried on by Jonathan and others, Bruce and others, on the paradox principle, these are not simply exercises, from my standpoint, which are interesting exercises to provide nourishment or entertainment for our people. These are indispensable activities by which our members, including members of the sales force, can reach within themselves to find a comprehension of what the word ideas in the Platonic sense means. Because without understanding ideas in that way, how can you understand what is truth? And if you can't understand truth, how can you be truthful? And if you can't be truthful in that way, how can you be moral? Not in the sense of not sodomizing the policeman walking by or his dog, but in the sense of being large, not small, being engaged with saving civilization and saving the human race, reaching out to people and using the same principles with the people you're talking to or attempting to organize, to use these principles of education and ideas to evoke within them the process of discovering ideas in their own mind. And then they will look to you with joy, with agape, because they realize that you, in talking to them, have activated something within them which they admire greatly, having seen it. And they look to you as a friend, and us as friends, because we represent that which they in themselves find beautiful." So I thought that was an interesting way to look at the scientific method. So without further ado, Mr. Ouyang.
Okay, all right. Well, hopefully we're getting a different idea of what revolutionary means. And what I'm going to try to go through, and I'll try to keep it a little shorter than, relatively succinct. But we just went through a lot of stuff, and we just kind of touched on the surface of it. The implications are really revolutionary, and it should take a while to sink in. What this could mean for the future of humanity and for the future of science. So what I'm going to look at is kind of, if you want to shift your mindset a little bit, if you've got the stamina left to shift your mindset, to look at how can we begin to understand what the political, do you have a question? Or? No. What the political relevance of this discovery in itself, but also discovery as a principle is, and what we represent in terms of the political intervention as a movement. Because what have we been doing? Today we've been really looking at the nature of space. When Kepler was looking at the harmonies of the world or the solar system, he wasn't looking for a formula to describe some phenomenon that he observed. He wasn't looking for formulas. He was actually seeking after something more profound and more substantial, which LaRouche has touched on a lot recently, which is intention. It wasn't that Kepler was trying to determine causes by adding up effects, but he asked the question fundamentally, what is the nature of God's mind that makes necessary all of the discoveries that
as he would put it, we have the pleasure of making throughout our lifetime. In other words, what's the nature of the space, or what's the nature of the geometry in which we're operating in? So, you know, in his work, we can actually, that's where we get an indication of the, what's known as the negentropic development of the universe. In other words, that it's tending towards higher forms of organization. Somewhat of, we see a personality reflected in this. And, you know, you see it in the musical intervals. These are things that we might not have touched on today, but are, should be in the general discussions that we're having. If you have any questions, there's lots of people that can answer it. But, you know, we see that in fact, there's somewhat of a living principle embedded in like we were saying, the macrocosm. And that we see reflected in Moon's hypothesis in the microcosm as well. So, you know, and it's kind of appropriate because the development of modern chemistry really began with the study of life. It wasn't looking up dead things and trying to figure, you know, add that up. You know, so you get a sense of kind of a living, developing world that you live in. But if we were, you know, if we were out here talking about this kind of stuff and we weren't with the LaRouche youth movement, you know, waging a political revolution, we might get the wrong idea and start, you know, rolling around in the mud and worshiping Gaia and Mother Earth and saying everything's alive, let's let's be one with this universe, right? So we can be a little more scientific. We can actually turn to another great mind, a man named Vladimir Vernadsky, who was the founder of biogeochemistry. And he was born in Russia in 1863. And, you know, he was born into actually a political family. His father was organizing for a constitutional republic in Russia. You know, he studied crystallography, mineralogy, and other natural sciences, and he was actually a student of Dmitri Mendeleev, who developed the periodic table, or at least was influenced by him. And so he also, Vernadsky also studied with Marie Curie in Paris. He helped to establish atomic science in Russia. He founded over, you know, 20 scientific institutions, and he made fundamental breakthroughs in and, you know, was the founder of this field of biogeochemistry. But he wasn't just a scientist; he was also a statesman. You know, he served in the parliament or in the house of in Russia, in addition to other functions. But Vernadsky was the first to develop this conception of the biosphere, which some of you may have heard about. In this biosphere, he saw the interaction of these three distinct kind of phase spaces or domains of action in the universe. You have the living, the non-living, and the noetic, which was the action of the human mind, consciousness. And he saw that there was a hierarchy in the development of each of these three phase spaces. So in the same way that living processes can, you know, are a form of a higher organized form of matter, that they have more organization over non-life, you know, the noetic actually organizes both the abiotic and the biotic. So it's this multiply connected idea of the universe. And he saw the biosphere as kind of, it's the living envelope of the planet. It's a place of transformation. As probably all of you can feel, it's a place where you get lots of cosmic energy, right? You've been sitting out in the sun for 2 hours. But it's where you have this, you know, we're taking largely solar energy with some other cosmic energy and transforming this chemically and otherwise, that this is what living organisms do. And we create, you know, living organisms have created the atmosphere, you know, most of the stuff that we see around us. And so this is where the kind of free energy of the planet is being produced. This is called the biogeochemical energy. So this is really what's doing the work, is this biosphere. And he was rigorous, and he was looking, he saw that, let me show you, this is Vernadsky. He saw that living processes were actually increasingly penetrating into the crust, that they were exerting more and more dominion, I guess, over the development of the planet as a whole. And that without living processes, you would really have a totally static, dead planet, that you'd have no new minerals created, and that, in fact, there'd be very little change, and whatever change would happen very slowly. So that you actually see that most of the physical characteristics of the biosphere, which is what we live in, has been touched or created by living processes, by life. The minerals that we use, right? The elements that we use. And so he saw in this process of development of the biosphere, from the standpoint of this idea of biogeochemical energy, in other words, the free energy to do more work, right? That's what a living process does. It takes in a certain amount of energy and creates a certain amount of energy, and in fact, you get more out than what you put in, which is unique to life. And unique to most college students probably too, but that in fact that the planet is moving towards higher forms of biogeochemical energy. In other words, it's getting more organized. And he saw he was actually Vernadsky was also looking at the nature of space, and he had this hypothesis that living organisms. Life is actually expresses a completely unique kind of space-time. That it's not, first of all, you couldn't understand it from non-living things. You couldn't kind of just add up the interactions of the molecules and figure out what life was. But so how could you get at these very unique properties of life? He said that, well, maybe that there's actually a distinct kind of phase space that life inhabits. He said. And this a lot of this came from looking at the work of Pasteur, Louis Pasteur, and right and left-handedness, which we took up at the last cadre school. But this is an excerpt from his paper on biogeochemistry. He said, Pasteur recognized the possibility of different states of cosmic space, by which he explained his discovery that living matter exhibits dissymmetry. Indeed, we should see in the state of space the basic geometrical substrate for all of its material. And energetic manifestations. So the scientific hypothesis of a special geometrical structure of space for bodies of living matter is admissible and requires verification. A space not corresponding to Euclidean geometry, but lying at the basis of the material, energetic, and temporal properties of living matter, distinguishing it from the inert natural bodies of the biosphere. And for all of us in the movement that have been working on Riemann and Gauss and kind of getting at past a sort of fixed Cartesian Euclidean view of the universe, this should be very exciting. But so you have the composition of the planet constantly being transformed, not just by biotic processes, but more importantly by the noetic. By the intervention of man's consciousness, that he recognized was a much more powerful force on the planet than even living processes. The way he looked at life was from the standpoint of something called the biogenic migration. These are very interesting terms, but basically, that through life you have this cycling through of matter, of atoms, through respiration, through eating, moving around, stuff on the planet, and that as the higher forms of life will do more of this. And with us, we do this all the time. It doesn't just depend on what we eat and kind of poop out, but the fact that we're moving materials all over the planet, that we're actually moving through the sky, higher than any other form of life, that we're actually inhabiting parts of the biosphere that nobody else can touch. And so he saw this biogenic migration of atoms, this kind of whirlpool of atoms, whirlwind of atoms that get cycled through living processes and then expelled back out into the biosphere. He saw this is also increasing towards a maximum. Right? So from this standpoint, you can begin to think about things like evolution. And Vernadsky's conception of the biosphere was that it was a necessary part of the structure of the development of the planet as a whole, and that there was a that that
So this, you know, looking at things like this biogenic migration could help us to understand what directionality the planet was taking, the biosphere is taking. But here's the thing, right? With humans, you have this kind of you have this power to change the planet. Normally, especially from the biogeochemical standpoint, you don't really care about individuals. You're looking at organisms as a whole, you know, the biosphere as a whole, all the living matter. But it's only when you get into people that you have to deal with personalities, especially when you're in the youth movement. But these personalities, what's unique about human individuals is that an individual can act as a geologic force on the planet, right? We're not just kind of like all part of this great noetic consciousness that's just kind of moving and taking over the planet like the blob, right? The way that the noosphere, this domain of you know, human mental activity, the way that that's expressed is uniquely through the individual, right? The sovereign creative acts of an individual mind. And that's, so the question is, how does that then transform itself as a planetary phenomenon? I mean, on the planet as a whole, you're just one person, right? I mean, you know, somebody like, I guess, Marx or you know, would think of it as, you know, it's just by your hard labor, right? If you dug a big old hole or something, that would be a geological force. But that's not what Vernadsky was getting at. So where does the transformation, so going from a discovery of principle, a unique, you know, individual discovery of principle, where your mind is in an unmediated relationship with the universe, well, how do you then go to an expression of that principle to change the universe? And that's kind of, you know, that's where we have to get into, okay, well, our impact then is going to have to be, you know, our impact on the physical world is going to have to be mediated through how we organize ourselves politically and socially as a whole in society. Because this is the basis for economics, is how do we do that to increase our potential relative population density? Right? So this is where LaRouche's idea of the Eurasian land bridge, this is where this concept comes from. But it's not a new idea. I mean, it's actually, it's continuing the work of Vernadsky's predecessor, Mendeleev, who was involved in the development of really the first land bridge, the first Eurasian land bridge in Russia. Because, so just quickly on Mendeleev, he was born in 1834. He was a fellow Russian. He was also a successor to Lavoisier, who, you know, helped basically founded modern chemistry. He was very much following in his footsteps. And, you know, he developed the periodic table in looking at these elements as expressing certain cycles in nature. But like Vernadsky, and in fact like Lavoisier, he wasn't just a scientist, but he was a statesman. He was political. He was, in fact, key to the industrialization of Russia. He was brought in under the Ministry of Finance with another guy named Sergei Vit to oversee the construction of the Trans-Siberian Railroad, which was to connect, you know, the Pacific with Europe through Siberia, through the you know, the cold plains. And think about it. I mean, at the time that this is, you know, who dominated shipping at this time? The British. That this is not just a way to exploit the resources in Siberia or in these inland areas or move populations there, but this is really about how you assert your sovereignty as a nation. And Mendeleev was very much aware of the connection between science and the development of the nation state, that, you know, in chemistry in particular for industrialization, that they both depend on each other. That, you know, science is necessary for the nation state. He realized, especially in this new era, where before all you needed was muscle, he said now the fate of nations is going to rest on how well they do scientifically. But the nation state but science is also really can't fully develop without the nation state. So you have a self-reflexive kind of relationship there. which in fact you'll see with pretty much any process you look at. But I'll just read a quick quote from Mendeleev to get an idea of what he, you know, sort of how he was looking at this. This is in his book, The Principles of Chemistry. He says, "Chemistry, like every other science, is at once a means and an end. It is a means of attaining certain practical results. Thus, by its assistance, the obtaining of matter in its various forms is facilitated. It shows new possibilities of availing ourselves of the forces of nature, indicates the methods of preparing many substances, points out their properties, etc. In this sense, chemistry is closely connected with the work of the manufacturer and the artisan. Its sphere is active and is a means of promoting general welfare." He goes on, "Besides this honorable vocation, chemistry has another. With it, as with every other elaborated science, there are many lofty aspirations, the contemplation of which serves to inspire its workers and adherents. This contemplation comprises not only the principal data of the science, but also the generally accepted deductions, and also hypotheses which refer to phenomena as yet but imperfectly known. In this latter sense, scientific contemplation varies much with the times and persons. It bears the stamp of creative power and embraces the highest forms of scientific progress. In that pure enjoyment experienced on approaching to the ideal, in that eagerness to draw aside the veil from the hidden truth, and even in that discord which exists between the various workers, we ought to see the surest pledges of further scientific progress. Science thus advances, discovering new truths and at the same time obtaining practical results. To conceive, understand, and grasp the whole symmetry of the scientific edifice, including its unfinished portions, is equivalent to tasting that enjoyment only conveyed by the highest forms of beauty and truth." And if anybody that reads Kepler can kind of see shades of sort of that passion in Mendeleev. But so when we're looking at the biosphere and our relationship to it, we say, okay, we're responsible for this. We have to manage it. In fact, that's our task, you know, as a nation state, is to manage the biosphere. And that's really what the function of infrastructure is. It's probably the least sexy word that we use in the LaRouche campaign. But that's because, you know, we should think about it the way Vernadsky does. So you have these sort of two ways to do this. Because on the one hand, we can just accelerate the processes of the biosphere, kind of the natural processes, right? We can green the deserts, can move certain things along where the, you know, nature itself would be a little slow in doing it. But we can also qualitatively change it, right? We can actually introduce new forms into the biosphere. This would be things like transportation and power, you know, mass transportation, power lines, urban development, this kind of stuff. So hopefully most people have seen something like this. Which is kind of the foundation for LaRouche's economic recovery program, which is the land bridge. It actually, a lot of it speaks for itself. I mean, in the sense that as soon as you just take this view, like you actually just look at this map with an intention to change things, you're already getting the point, which is, this is how we're going to manage not just relationships between countries, different civilizations, you know, wars and things like this for the next generations, but this is how we're actually going to be caretakers of the planet. And it's this long-term view that's you know, based on kind of our understanding of the relationship between concentrations of populations in various areas, long-term natural resources. You know, and mostly right now we're dealing with minerals and things like that. You know, and in this area you've got lots of them, but not a lot of people. I'm actually not going to go too much into the land bridge because we have lots of material on that. But I guess what I'd like people to do is just begin to conceive of these things. To begin to conceptualize these things from the standpoint of what we've discussed today. Right? is that the, you know, well, I could go into a little bit. This is, you know, it's what you're going to have is things like these transportation corridor or these development corridors, you know, where you're having high-speed rail, water, telecommunications, these kinds of things. Really, the function is to unleash a scientific, an economic, a cultural renaissance across the planet. And we're going to, the way that that's going to happen is we're going to have to put a lot of people to work studying things like this, getting fusion energy, finding new resources. And the idea is to you know, increase that ever-important potential relative population density. And if we kind of step back again and look at the planet as a whole, well, we'll leave that up there. But so, as living processes increase their kind of hold over the planet, you're having, you know, a more and more accumulation of fossils of living processes. Right? This is what a lot of the minerals are, the soil, these kinds of things, that they're effects produced from living processes. And this is actually superseded by the growth of noetic fossils, are the effects of human thought, right? I mean, look at the way that we shift things around the planet. Look at the way that we're able to actually change the geography by virtue of the fact that you would have a maglev rail going through the, you know, the high plains or something. So infrastructure, the land bridge, this is really where we're bridging, you know, the noetic with the abiotic and the biotic. And this is where we begin to get an idea of how we're going to make this, how you can actually make universal individual potential. In other words, how an individual in society can actually have an impact on the whole planet. And I'll read a quick quote from LaRouche on this. He says, when we increase the availability of usable water, of sources of power, of increased energy flux density, of more rapid, more efficient transport of people and goods, we improve the available performance of each person in that society, even if no other change in their behavior is introduced. If we improve both sanitation and healthcare, thus reducing the economic losses attributable to illness, impairments, and death, we increase the productivity of that society as a whole. And in fact, he takes this up from the standpoint of Bernard Riemann and his work on kind of manifolds, that he investigated the same kind of questions of that there's no fixed sort of metric you can use to determine what space is. That in looking at Vernadsky's idea of this sort of what's the space-time of life, and then looking at the moon model, and just kind of considering the implications of what it means to see the way that that these hypotheses are organized. You see that in fact it's principles that organize space. That's what we're getting into. So here's the problem though. We're using up these resources quicker than they're getting made, right? So that's no problem, because we can just expand the noosphere. Right? There's no limits. This is also part of the strategy, right? Launch a Moon Mars program. Begin to actually investigate the universe, not from the standpoint of, you know, colonizing space or conquering new territory or real estate, but go to Mars to figure out what physical chemistry is like on Earth, how it developed in the solar system. I mean, ultimately, yeah, we don't want to stop. No, we should go. That's a picture of a Mars mission, but so that's the idea, is actually expand the biosphere, expand the noosphere. And as we get a better understanding of things like the moon model,
we can actually begin to look at things like transmutation, actually creating new resources, which is, you know, adding just creating new elements from understanding, you know, how they're made. And again, I'll refer to LaRouche on this. This is from a paper called On Tariffs and Trade. It says, thus, to discover those laws specific to our solar system, which lie above, below, and beyond what our scientific discoveries thus far have demonstrated, we must go beyond the upper and lower limits of investigation so far. We must discover laws characteristic of the solar system, but engaging principles expressed in ways beyond the frontiers of what our experience has enabled us to discover thus far. This means that we must choose the creating of an organized infrastructure of scientific exploration, embracing the moon, Mars, and the getting back and forth between them as the frontier of new dimensions of exploration, in search of newly discovered laws of our solar system, and inclusively its biogeochemistry. This must be conducted on an astronomical scale, but also simultaneously along the frontiers of nuclear microphysics. What I have just described is a reflection of the fundamental, but unfortunately rarely understood, principle of any competent form of economic science. The progress of man from the ape-like level of potential population of a few millions living individuals to more than 6 billion reported today is the outcome of the application of an accumulation of discoveries of principles, principles accumulated and largely transmitted across many successive generations, and also from one culture to another. The crucial feature of that process of increasing the potential relative population density of the human species is the act of original or replicated discovery of universal physical principles of the characteristics I have just once again summarized above. The embedding of these discovered intellectual powers in the culture of a society is that society's primary capital. However, the effective expression of that primary capital requires investment in the physical activities, including educational activities, and the physical structures through which those powers are efficiently expressed at the proverbial points of production and consumption. The activities expressing those levels corresponding to an array of powers are to be regarded as capital investment. As in basic economic infrastructure, in capital of production of goods, and in necessary capital of productive firms and of households. So that's economics. So this is, you know, if we look at this from the way Vernadsky looked at it, that the biosphere itself is also a function of the nature of space. There's something necessary for the creation of the biosphere. And living organisms, you know, aren't separated from that structure. And in the same way, you know, we should think about things like the land bridge, things about what we do to affect nature as necessary. Because we are, in fact, a necessary part of the development of the planet as a whole. And you can ask the question, could the planet survive without human beings? Right. So, the question, I guess, for us is, you know, how are, or for you individually, is how you're going to be a geologic force. Right? You're not going to do that sitting at home watching SpongeBob. Or, you know, hanging out with your folks all day. But hopefully what we've been able to do, or at least give you a sense of, is that maybe the way to take that up is to, you know, join Kepler, Lavoisier, Mendeleev, Vernadsky, Moon, and LaRouche, you know, in a fight to free the human mind. And I think we should wrap it up there, and if anybody has questions, we can take them now or maybe later.
What are we doing on time? I have a question on what is the relationship between the moon model and then electromagnetism?
What?
Relationship between the moon model and electromagnetism?
Oh. Well,
basically.
Oh, sorry. Or anybody, I guess, can answer if they can. Do you want to
want to say something, Ed?
Go ahead.
The relation, basically, from my just beginning to investigate this, from my understanding of it, it's the idea that it was these experiments that Ampere and then eventually Gauss and Weber were doing on, because, I mean, where, how could you investigate what a nucleus of an atom was if you don't know what an atom is? Or how could you investigate what the electron configuration of the atom is if you don't know what an electron is, right? So the reason why these Gauss-Weber, the electromagnetism experiments were important, were, or how that led in, rather, to the moon model, is that that was the beginnings of actually understanding electricity, of actually seeing electricity as this idea of, that it's actually an electron, it's some kind of charge, negative charge moving through this. I mean, they were still, and we still this day don't, I mean, like, for example, when we were doing this electromagnetic experiment with Sky and me and Ardina, I was asking Sky, so what is actually happening? So we know that, you know, you wrap these coils around the metal and you get, it becomes a magnet, but what's actually happening inside that piece of metal? You know, and you know, basically Sky was like, really, the scientists don't really know what's happening. I mean, that's what I meant by the fact that we're on the cutting edge of this research. Like, a lot of these questions still do not have answers, that, you know, nobody knows what the answers are. There's certain hypotheses, you know, which, and one thing I thought I should have mentioned when I was bringing up the moon model is that this is not like a hard and fast, again, you could almost turn the moon model into a linear model as well. I mean, it's a hypothesis, you know, it's a metaphor for trying, I mean, there's not cubes and tetrahedrons, you know, floating around in between the planets, just like there's not cubes and tetrahedrons, you know, down. But it's a metaphor for trying to understand an ordering principle. Because I was thinking about it the way that we've been working through the Gauss paper, where, you know, Gauss is saying, well, no, algebra isn't just this manipulation of these, mathematical formulas. The formulas are the shadows, and we're going to create these Gaussian surfaces as a geometrical construction to try to visualize something that is not, that you can't see. You know, to represent an unseen principle. So you could, I kind of was thinking the moon model in that way, that it's sort of like almost like a Gaussian surface in the sense of trying to construct a geometrical construction to try to see something that we really can't see, you know, in the visual domain, this ordering. So, if you wanted to add anything to that, or anybody else?
Jason? I just mentioned that.
Well, I think it has a lot to do with what Jason was saying, is that when you're dealing with chemistry in general, you're dealing with shadows. So in order to try to get at the nature of the get at the nature of matter, you approach things much in the way that Mendeleev did. You try to find an ordering principle that speaks to your own sense of what's truthful. Kepler actually had a very beautiful way of looking at this, is that the universe is composed in such a way that by the creator of the universe that you would find it beautiful. So there's definitely a harmonic relationship between the noetic, between the mind, and the principles of the universe in general. But as far as electricity and magnetism go, it's a good way of trying to get at the development of an epistemological fight for atomic science, because, like I briefly mentioned, Newton did a pretty good hatchet job on Kepler, and all of science really suffered. You had Mendeleev working on these things about the time of, Mendeleev was working with people in the United States on the railroads and things like that. So, but that's like 1860, right? So you have this fight made a personal intervention by Ampere around this question of Newton's wrong, and all you guys are too mentally blocked to really understand what's happening. He does it politically. He does it in a certain way diplomatically, and it still totally freaks out people like Weber and other scientists. But Gauss, as we, you know, as movement understand from looking at his 1799 paper, has this key element of a fighting spirit, of a passion for the real truth, not just some respectable surrogate. Gauss, by that time in his life, is actually somewhat beaten down. A lot of political operations are waged against him following 1799. As he grows up, he becomes more and more, I wouldn't say afraid, it's not the right quality that I'm looking for, but he definitely becomes more concerned with how he says things, how they'll be accepted. But nonetheless, he's the one responsible for organizing Weber back to this sense of, look, we've got to do this, we've got to go with this to actually support an advance of the field of, you know, science in general, especially around this work done in electromagnetics.
But I'd say in particular on that question, the moon model and electromagnetism, Larry has a new paper that's a draft, but it's very specifically on, it's got a very large section on the magnetism, looking at, like, you know, because iron appears as a singularity, iron is incredibly magnetic, gadolinium, which is also kind of locally very magnetic compared to all of its neighbors, it shows up as a really interesting singularity. So he's got a paper on that, and I'd also say look at the way he treats neutrons as protons with electrons condensed onto them. Because it gives this sort of coherence between the nucleus and then the electrons, which seem totally separated in the Bohr model.
Do you guys have any idea how you would go about fusion? Like, I could see kind of how the splitting of the atom would work for nuclear power. And, like, thermonuclear, the eclipse, the shell, kind of thing, you have that explosion thing, but I don't see how you...
We already do it, you know. Like nuclear bombs and things.
Yeah, but I'm warning, like, yeah. For energy, like, to produce, like you do with fission.
I don't know, it might be a long thing. We've written a lot on it. but read this moon stuff.
I can say something just quick. Like, the important thing is that you have a measurement of energy. This idea of stable orientations of nuclear geometry is important because this idea that you have a uranium nucleus that's broken apart that results in an excess of energy that can be then used, you know, harnessed for, say, you know, turning water into steam or heating a gas that expands, which then is driving some type of turbine. Turns mechanical energy into electricity. But in the case of a fusion, we had nuclear bombs that actually take a fission reaction, takes the explosion of a fission reaction and compresses a kind of a fusion pellet. So under this extreme pressure, you have the joining of protons, or really, I mean, a hydrogen nucleus is really just a proton. But you have joining of these things to compress into a helium nucleus. That change from two hydrogens into, well, you have to add two neutrons, but it happens in the process. You have this compression, which then results actually in an excess of energy also. And it's a much smaller space, too, so you can pack a lot more fuel for this type of fusion reaction. I don't actually know if the energy, like, compared to uranium, you know, like a mole, like the energy, like by mole, is more. I'm not sure about it. It is okay. We got somebody that's taken physics. Yeah. So what you're dealing with is a higher order of what is properly called energy flux density. But that just means kind of you're dealing with the next step up in terms of the type of energy potential you have to generate. Electricity, these kind of things.
So we just don't know how to harness it yet for power source?
No, we actually do. The problem is political, not technological. You need something like what LaRouche is recommending in terms of financing mechanisms to generate the research and development credit, preferably cheap credit, amortized over the long run. This would give you not only the ability to invest, you know, big money up front to build laboratories and try to give scholarship to scientists who want to do